space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop, there it is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, how you doing? You're listening to the Mad Science Show at www.shazoozradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one but four separate chat rooms. Whew, as well, you can scroll down there underneath the four separate chat rooms and you can click on the People for People radio link and go over there and join those awesome folks and tell them no crazy haired Shazooz sent you. I'm going to be starting up the Twitch live stream. It's duct tape and baling wire as usual, so we're going to see if we can get by with this today. Weather's terrible outside. It's cold and all get out. And so we're going to try to live stream some Twitch TV at the same time while doing our live broadcast. Hopefully everything goes as well as planned. So I'll go ahead and start that stream over there and make sure everything's functioning properly. And then I'll post the links over there into the Super Chat and probably on Skype as well. So anyway, let me bear with me for a second here. Okay, Twitch TV, yeah, this is bad for live radio. I know, I get that problem all the time. It's so cold outside, folks, you would not believe how cold it is. It's like a blizzard out there. It's freezing cold outside. So we got to get our energy thing under control so we can always make sure that we got power for just such an emergency. I'm also going to post that over there on Facebook as well. So let me do that. Yep, this is the way it goes here. So hopefully the stream will hold up. Hopefully the power won't go out, because they're talking about a whole bunch of ice and all that kind of stuff. Better type of message in here too. Mad science. Come on there. Yeah. I just done messed up here. You ever wonder why computers want to give you such a hassle all the time? See, mad. There we go. Mad science is live on Twitch. Okay. TV. Alright. I missed. Yeah, that's it. That's right. Twitch. I think that's right. Alright. Put dead in there. Alright. Give me a second here, folks. I'll get my act together. There we go. Alright. So, I posted it over there on Facebook. Now I'm going to stay on page. Ed, burn it. Alright, so I'm going to post it over here now. Yeah. We got to make sure everybody can not only see what's going on, they can hear what's going on. So we're trying to use doggone technology here. Duct tape and baling wire. Copy link location. There we go. That'll work. Alright, put that in there. Sorry about that. That's messed up. I got it all messed up. Let's try this again. Let's see if we can do it this way. Alright, so basically what I want to talk to you about today is energy storage, because with renewable alternative energies and such, you need to be able to have some way to store power for those days when the wind ain't blowing or the sun ain't shining and all that kind of stuff. But before I start running my mouth off about what we should be doing, I got a few podcasts to play out so that you can hear what everybody else out there has been saying about energy storage and technologies and such. I tried to look up a top 10 technology thing, and I couldn't find any top 10 list of energy storage systems. Now, we all know about batteries. A few of us know about capacitors. I'm sold on capacitors because capacitor technology has gotten pretty amazing. And so with that said, we'll be able to store massive amounts of power. But it's not just the storage of power that needs to change. It's actually how we use electricity to begin with. And so when we get that sorted out, we'll be able to reach an amazing amount of efficiency and therefore be able to... Let me get over here and look and see whether or not I'm broadcasting on that. I'm going to mute that mic here after I hear myself echoing in the background.
Amazing.
Yep, there we go. Okay, we're good to go now. We're good to go! Woohoo! So, if you jump on Twitch, you'll be able to see right now just my experiment and still be able to hear me. But if I got something to show you, you'll be able to see it. So, let's see here. If you jump over there on Twitch, throw in a smiley face and say hi. I better do that right now because I haven't done that yet. Smiley face. Come on. Man, what the heck is going on there? I think I figured it out. Alright. Oh, you gotta hit that again. There we go. Smiley face in the chat room. Alright, let's get on with this thing right here. First, I'm gonna start playing this podcast right here. And this one here is about energy storage, but they're all about energy storage. I just want you to hear what the people
According to the Executive Director of the Energy Storage Association, Matt Roberts, energy storage is changing the paradigm of how we generate, distribute, and use energy. As bold a statement as that is, it's not unreasonable to suggest that last year was a breakout year for technology. Talked about often vague and unnecessarily technical terms, investors have struggled to get a firm handle on what this game changer of innovation means for the energy landscape. The electric grid is based on 100-year-old technology that is inflexible and in need of considerable upgrades. Energy storage touches every part of the electric system, and in doing so changes the paradigm and provides value to every stakeholder. The market for these technologies is on course to almost double in the next decade, and investment in thermal energy storage, batteries, compressed air, molten salt, flywheels, and a load of other advanced technologies is set to explode. In the US alone, energy storage capacity in 2016 grew by 242%, eclipsing the previous 2 years combined, and investments in energy storage reached over $400 million. The emergence of new energy startups like Stem, Green Charge Network, etc., and not to mention household names like Tesla and GE, have given observers good reason to feel optimistic. If successful, improvements in energy storage technology could render petrol tanks redundant, and the benefits could extend to every part of the value chain. Already, the utilities sector is partway through its biggest change in a century, and so too are the capital markets that serve it. The gathering competitiveness and complexity of renewables also means that energy companies can ill afford to ignore enabling technologies like storage that not only facilitate renewables penetration, but also give it a more decentralized system of generation. According to Ernst & Young's Renewable Energy Countries Attractions Index, utilities must redefine and immediately their business propositions if they are to survive in a more decentralized landscape and serve the emerging class of producer consumers. Utilities and grid operators in particular support energy storage as a more cost-effective and flexible solution for non-traditional energy technologies. At the distributed scale, energy storage allows more effective load control and reliability benefits, creating a more responsive and resilient grid. Because it provides value at every scale, energy storage is a critical facet of a smarter grid, and its flexibility accelerates our deployment of clean technologies like wind and solar. More generally, the decline in battery prices and the emergence of government incentives to support energy storage systems also means utilities and energy companies more generally are ploughing investment into such technologies. In short, the challenge that energy solutions are seeking to address is one of intermittency and the ability to store energy in times of plenty, supplying it in times of scarcity. This is a crucial part of the renewables equation. Energy storage can create a more flexible and efficient grid and drive renewable growth in two major ways. First, consistent output makes it easier to interconnect renewables, and secondly, energy storage reduces the need amongst utilities for capital-intensive investments in inefficient systems. Storage is not deconstructing centralized systems of electricity generation, although this is not to say that the development of these technologies isn't any less revolutionary. Changing the paradigm of how we generate, distribute, and use energy with a better description, although questions remain as to whether these technologies can generate consistent returns. A couple of years ago, Tesla unveiled Tesla Energy. They described it as a suite of batteries for homes, businesses and utilities that are looking to foster a clean energy ecosystem and help wean the world off fossil fuels. Some, however, saw the gamble on residential-level installations as a short-sighted one. For example, 90% of the energy storage capacity installed over the last few years has been bought by utilities, and the number of commercial and industrial owners equates to just 1%. The advent of storage technologies, in particular on the commercial and residential front, will take time. According to Moody's, incremental improvements in existing battery technologies mean costs have fallen somewhere between 50% over the last 5 years. A Lazard's report shows that advances in storage technologies offer no signs of abating in the next 5 years, and they indicate they could hit the point where they displace gas-fired capacity. Frost and Sullivan's data show that globally the market for utility-scale grid-connected storage amounted to $460 million in 2014, and they forecast it will reach $8.3 billion before 2025. While the monetary worth of the home storage market is significantly lower, its growth is rising fast. Research indicates that almost 14,000 battery units were installed in the first 9 months of 2015. That was a double the rate that we saw in 2014. While the latest numbers from Tesla indicate they installed almost 30,000 battery units in 2016. Surely the energy storage technology that features most heavily on investors' radar is the lithium-ion battery, which without a doubt receives the largest share of investment and will remain the dominant form of battery storage for at least the next few years. The ability to power consumer electronics and electric cars for longer has created a significant lead ahead of their rival technologies. However, they don't come cheap. As Brett Simon, an energy storage analyst, suggested, in terms of technology right now, the US energy storage market is dominated by lithium-ion batteries, and they can provide both short and medium-term duration services. Furthermore, lithium-ion batteries have undergone a massive cost reduction in the last few years, driven in part by consumer electronics and also by the automotive industry. Molten salt, lead acid and flow batteries are likewise giving utility companies reason to invest. Across the spectrum, companies like Panasonic, Samsung, Tesla, GE and a string of major companies are clamouring for a slice of the pie, and their investments are ushering in many of the most impressive new developments. Energy storage is not one technology, it's a way of applying technology. Whether utilitized for generation, distribution or even load, the ability to store energy is inherently valuable, and this allows utilities to focus on new alternatives. When you can store energy, it changes the way that you plan the system. It impacts every facet of integrated resource planning, and it looks like it will revolutionize the energy landscape.
Alright, so basically, you know, energy storage in the mainstream so far is really, really interesting and promising as far as technologies go, but personally, I think they're pretty much overstating the importance of energy storage. For example, that we've already got it figured out how to generate electrical power. That's not the problem. The problem is for those days when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing or whatever, if you're near a river, you're going to constantly have something going on. Nature's always got something going on, so if you have systems designed specifically with redundancy, you know, basically backup for a backup, then you got a system where you're going to have power all the time no matter what happens. If you live in the desert or, you know, an environment where there's a lot of heat involved, like, you know, there's a lot of volcanoes in Hawaii, they shouldn't have any energy storage problems at all because they could get energy on demand like right now. As far as that goes, if the world would set up and pay attention, we could actually be completely off the power grid within 30 days' time with technologies that are already pre-existing. And I'm not just talking about solar panel. I'm talking about hydrogen technology, including battery storage. There's once you understand how energy is actually doing what it's doing, then from that point on, it's about how you want to guide that power to where you want it to go. It's as simple as that. But as far as the mainstream and all the billions and dollars that are put into the research and development, they're coming up with you know, really impressive battery technologies, really impressive capacitor technologies and such. And, you know, basically trying to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, because they don't understand what's actually occurring here. If they did understand what's actually occurring here, they could take all the technologies that existed right now and re-engineer a few things, start using technologies that already existed to put those pieces of the puzzle together into what they want to call sustainable units or energy or whatever like that. But right now, this if you're on looking in on Twitch, you'll see I got a system set up over here, and there's only one battery in the entire deal, and that battery is actually being used to charge, and it's charging that battery up, which is helping to sustain the power stored in the capacitors themselves. So right there is an energy storage solution using multiple different types of capacitors in order to be able to do a certain task each time it's needed. Now you go to air up your tire in your car. If you got an air tank and it only has 35 pounds of pressure in it, 35 PSI for you technical geeks, but if you got 35 PSI in a tank and then you got a tire that needs 35 PSI in there, when you try to put that air into that tire, you're only going to be able to get that tire halfway filled up. And so you're going to have half the air pressure in the tank and the other half in the tire. So it's going to balance itself out. Electricity works exactly the same exact way. And so science tells us that voltage is pressure. Some like to call it tension. Whatever they want to, you know, look. you know me, I'm not into high-tech terminology. I want to tell you in the basic simple of how it actually is. Not how, you know, that somebody wants to make it sound like they're really highly intelligent in order to tell you something. Oh, yeah, that dude's real smart. Well, yeah, when you go to air up your tire, you got half amount of air in your tank and you got half amount of air in your tire, and your tire is still basically considered flat. It's only half full. It's not going to do the job it was intended on. The physics won't allow. And so with that said, you've got to be able to store more pressure in that tank than you want in that tire. Well, that's where voltage comes in. If you got a massive amount of voltage, you can store that massive amount of voltage in the line of pressure. So with that said, now we got to figure out how we're going to get these energy hogs that we are trying to run with just voltage. Well, right now we've got a massive amount of voltage in this system that I've got right now. I'm running a DDS signal generator at 60 hertz with a square wave, pulsing a microwave oven transformer that is putting voltage pressure through high voltage out of the secondary down through some AC capacitors, through a bridge rectifier, into a storage bank of three capacitors running series, which right now is setting at 86.8 volts. That's a lot of stored pressure. Now the entire system, for the most part, only needs, you know, anywhere from 9 to 12 volts in order to function. And I've got 86.8 in storage waiting to be used. And the key about this whole deal is there's actually no moving parts in this entire deal. It's basically all solid state. The only portion where there'd be moving parts is outside of where I'm actually drawing the power from, which is the AC wall adapters that I'm using on the grid. So I've got one 5-volt USB wall adapter, and I've got one 9-volt USB adapter. The only time I need to use the 9-volt adapter is when I need to raise the voltage pressure up to sustain what's going on. And so the rest of the time, I'm just pushing sheer voltage into the storage bank using the 5-volt one. So now we're talking about efficiency. Once you get into efficiency, then that means you're going to be using that power in the most efficient manner in order to do the task that you want to get done. So, with that said, this is the way that we use our power off of the grid right now. If you was to build you a storage bank and you start storing up energy power, you can run everything you've got off of the energy power that you stored up, and that way it takes the load off the grid, all right? And it also takes the load off of your power input side, and everything is running off of that storage bank. Now, when you get down to battery technology, batteries do not like to charge and discharge rapidly. They're not really designed for that. However, now, if you understand the modern day capacitor technology, you've got multiple different types of capacitors, both AC and DC capacitors. You've got what they call super capacitors and boost caps that act more like a battery than they are a capacitor. But nonetheless, keeping that in mind, even the super caps and the boost caps have a charge and discharge that you need to factor in. the regular DC capacitors and the regular AC capacitors, like the AC run capacitors and just the regular DC capacitors, they will allow for a smooth flow of that energy, and they will allow for smoothing out the signal and storage as well. So you can actually store a lot of voltage pressure in just your average DC capacitor, which is very important. If you store that power, now when you go to run a load off of that right there, then that input device that you use, whether it be a generator or, you know, some sort of solid state circuitry, doesn't have to work near as hard in order to keep that energy flowing forward. So we're storing pressure, and we're using that pressure to push the energy forward and bleed that pressure on down into capacitor banks. And so when you store that energy in the capacitor banks and bleed it off down into your supercapacitors or your boost capacitors, now that takes the load off of everything down the line. So basically you're putting a buffer in between everything you want to run and every device that's actually pushing the power forward for you to run. This process right here would actually save you your batteries from, because battery technology, even though it's really good at this point in time and getting better by the day, it's quite expensive. So in order to build a massive battery bank, it's quite expensive. Well, when you get into buying capacitors, they used to be really, really expensive, but now they're actually getting down there a little bit to where they're almost affordable for the average Joe. Folks, they're going to accidentally give you free energy, regardless of whether they want to or not. The technology is advancing so rapidly that before it's all said and done, they're going to give you the tools necessary to make free energy. No ifs, ands, or buts. Look, if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough, because nature is full of it. You've got energy surrounding you all over the place, and there's people out there that'll say that that's stupid. No, there ain't, and you got this and that. Whatever. They got the mindset of the school book so embedded into their minds that they just can't look past into the future. Now, what I'm talking about doing is taking and redesigning how we actually use the power to begin with. Understanding why your appliances get hot, where the losses are. If it, in the perfect system, there would be absolutely no losses. You would recover the heat from anything, and there's so many different ways to actually turn that heat back into electricity using what's called the Seebeck effect, which basically a couple different types of metals, you heat one side of it, and those two types of metals actually produce electricity, you know, like thermocouples, thermopiles, Peltier elements, and so on. But those are methods by which you can transfer heat back into, you know, usable power. Well, you can also use that heat to transfer around to do another job, like maybe to heat your room or something like that. These computers that I'm running here right now, they actually help to supplement the heat, because, you know, when those transistors and MOSFETs and processors get hot, they actually produce heat. And so we already know, without trying, how to produce heat using electricity. All we need to figure out is how we can actually use this power so incredibly efficiently that whatever would have been generated that would have otherwise been known as a loss is no longer a loss. It's the energy that is either used or stored. You can store heat energy, you can store air pressure, you can store voltage pressure, you can store, you know, water pressure. There's so many different methods by which to do all of what I just mentioned. It's mind-blowing. So, you know, if you look out there and you see all the different types of energy storage systems, you'll find multitudes of types of different ways to store energy, including, you know, with molten salt, where they heat salt up with the sunlight and it stays hot all the way during the daytime or during the nighttime. And they use that to generate thermoelectrics. So yeah, they're gonna inadvertently give you free energy. They've already had, as far as I'm concerned. But you're going to have to keep your eyeball out to see what works the best in all that kind of stuff. What's going to suit your needs for your particular environment? If it's cold outside, that doesn't mean that you can't get free electricity. It just means you got to go about it a different way, because there's all kinds of ways to do it. You can pick up static electricity. You can pick up energy out of the air. And all that energy can be stored. So with that said, I'm going to move on to the next podcast right here. See what they have to say.
For decades, we've been powering our appliances and our homes with coal, natural gas, solar, wind, and even diesel like this power plant behind us. But there's something else keeping the lights on. Batteries. That brings us to this. Tesla and Kauai partnered to build a 13-megawatt solar farm. Now, it fills about 45 acres. Now, all that solar energy, it's going to fill these. These are Tesla power packs. It's 52 megawatt hours of energy that Kauai will be able to use to power its houses at night.
The entire state of Hawaii is committed to a 100% renewable future for electricity generation. Kauai is leading the pack.
We live on an island, we live in paradise. This is one of the most beautiful places on the planet.
During the daylight hours, prime sunlight hours, with all the solar that's going on, we're hitting 97, as high as 99% renewable penetration. So we realize that we can't keep adding more solar, because it's just going to be creating curtailment, and that's going to really hurt the economics.
Because electricity demand tends to be very smooth throughout the day, but renewable energy production depends upon the availability of the solar resource or the wind resource, which can be extremely intermittent throughout the day. That's going to have to be met with storage.
And so the challenge is not generating energy, because we can do that. The challenge is being able to capture that energy and then really being able to deliver it when the consumer needs it. And this project does that.
We're here at the Tesla solar facility, coupled with energy storage here in the island of Kauai, in Hawaii. And this is one of the world's first facilities where we're directly integrating solar with storage at the same site.
What is really exciting about this project is that it's dispatchable solar. So we are charging the batteries during the day and storing the energy. And then we will be able to use it throughout the day whenever it's needed.
So we can provide that solar energy back to the customers and back to the grid with firm guaranteed reliability. Around the clock. Actually, even after the sun goes down, we can still keep providing the energy that was stored during the day from the batteries. You got a low cost fuel source, really, the sun and the panels, and declining cost batteries. It's a great opportunity for us out here in high cost areas to bring in renewables, avoid oil, and help everybody on the island.
Storage, to the extent that you're going to have these very aggressive renewable energy goals like California has. California has essentially a 33% renewable portfolio standard by 2020 and a 50% by 2030. California also has a storage mandate, which is mandating the three investor-owned utilities in the state have at least 1,300 megawatts of storage capacity, which I think is certainly a start. But to find out, you know, greater amounts of storage, That really is going to depend on the economics.
Hawaii was the most dependent state in the country on imported fossil fuels. Even as recent as 5 years back, we were still over 90% reliant on imported fossil fuel for our electricity generation.
At the highest rate here, back when oil was pushing $150 a barrel, we were almost at 50 cents a kilowatt hour. We want to do things cheaper than have oil, and we don't want to be subject to the fluctuations from the petroleum market.
We made that commitment that we want a different future. We want to be isolated from foreign fuel markets prices, and we wanted to create jobs here.
Well, the big movement on Kauai's energy grid was in 2002, and the cooperative was formed here. It's one of the newest co-ops in the country. It's owned by the people.
So the consumer controls the company. So the community not only embraces the commitment to 100% clean renewable future, but it is the shareholders that are part of that equation.
Every day you drive by and you see this as an example of clean renewable energy, you know, sustainability, community involvement and engagement. And I I see it as something quite beautiful.
Energy storage is a transformational technology for the grid. It's one of the most interesting, I think, advances for the grid in 100 years.
To me, what's fascinating is the electric pricing for a residential customer is hanging somewhere around $200 a month for the average member. And we're holding steady, dropping, but I think a lot of other kind of utility-based costs like cable TV, internet, phones, all those costs are going up, whereas electricity is becoming less and less of a factor here on Kauai than it used to be. It's not their number one bill anymore. Some of them, they may be paying more for cellular coverage than they are for electricity, and it's an awful nice service they get relative to just having a cell phone.
Without storage, you can only have so much, because you need to have instantaneous matching between the loads and the generation. But with storage, we can break that, and we can suddenly have, you know, things like solar panels that can provide, ultimately, maybe all of the electricity that the grid needs. It allows the whole grid to operate much more efficiently, much more economically. You know, you don't have to have oversized, you know, generators and oversized wires everywhere to deal with the peak demands that only happen a brief period of the time. A lot of utilities, I think, are realizing the importance of this technology, and whether it's storage plus solar or both. I think every utility around the world is realizing this is going to impact their business model and wants to learn a lot about it.
One of the big question marks in all of this scaling renewables is, you know, suppose we have a 1 week long period where it's cloudy every day, we don't get any storage, what happens? How long can we last with the storage? And I think that's where Kauai can teach the, you know, rest of the world, as well as the United States, is, you know, what kind of storage do we need to be able to make it through these periods where we're not getting any renewable energy? You know, how much storage do we need for redundancy? What other mitigating measures can people take?
Now, island grid, subject to lengthy rain or storm events, we're probably never going to decommission our plants because we want them there for emergencies. Or we had a period 10 or 12 years ago where it rained for 40 days and 40 nights here, the biblical rain, and I don't see that we're ever going to have enough battery storage to cover a very long period like that. So you got to have conventional generation as backup.
Really, it makes very little sense to invest in storage unless you are really serious about renewables and scaling up renewables.
We need to build a lot of products. We need to ramp up our ability to build more battery packs, and we're doing that very quickly, but, you know, today that still is our limitation, is how many we can actually build.
We already have a way to store energy in a regime where we're not interested in only using renewable resources. It's called don't burn the fossil fuel. The important thing to remember about storage, even if it's the energy is coming from a renewable unit, is that it's the reverse of a battery charger, is that when you're charging something, in order to put that into the battery, some of the energy that you're trying to put in the battery is lost through heat. That means that you're getting less than the total amount of energy that you attempted to put in into that battery. So whereas in the case of, you know, storing the energy as fossil fuel, you're just not burning the energy, so there's no real waste of the energy in heat. It's just not being burned.
There's a lot of customer interest and a lot of different demand coming from all around the world. We're trying to scale up as fast as we can to meet all that, but right now that still is a challenge.
Prince Cohio, who got the legislation for our Hawaiian Homes Commission Act passed in the 20s, his intention was to have these lands rehabilitate our people. I think this Anahola Solar Farm, what it means to our community is hope and belief.
If we just, you know, showed people these prices, we would probably be able to get people to, on their own, invest in these storage devices, lower their annual electricity bills. That is what's going to get them to find it in their interest to make the sorts of decisions that are going to make the grid operate more efficiently.
We've already seen many folks come around, you know, and develop that sense of belief and seeing that it is something positive, and that it is definitely something that is good for our community, homesteaders, good for the island, good for the planet. I mean, there's so much good about this.
Surprisingly, storage has been, it has not had very many regulatory hurdles. I think it often solves regulatory problems, you know, where solar alone or wind alone, you know, may often, you know, be a bit more controversial because it puts a burden on the grid. Storage solves a lot of those problems.
Everyone talks about the housing and the farming. But there's more than that. There's also mercantile and community economic development. So this project, it represents to me the hope and belief in us doing exactly that. This can be an example of what more we can do as a community in community economic development.
Alright, so pretty much, you know, once again, batteries, storage, and all that kind of stuff. See, right now, we have the technology in order to ensure that even our transistors or our MOSFETs don't get too hot. You know, when we want to pulse, power, like when you take and use an AC inverter and you actually are taking a DC battery and you're energizing these transistors and MOSFETs and you're tripping them back off and on like that so that you can then in turn generate an AC wave and run the appliances we're using. Well, right now we're actually putting too much power to even those. The solid state systems in all of our circuitry, there's too much power being used, too much power being shoved at them. Every single device out there can only use so much power. There's a cutoff point. When you finally reach that cutoff point where the appliance can't use any more power, you still got power coming at it and constantly coming at it. More power, more power. Well, that generates heat and also generates resistance, which generates yet even more heat and causes these things to get hot. See, we think that because this current is flowing through this, that it's actually causing it to get hot. Well, that's not the case. The case is, most of them, like for diodes, for example, diodes don't need current in order to be able to do the job that they were set out to do. They will only allow electrons to flow in one direction. So that takes a AC wave and changes it into DC current, so that you don't, you can run something that would normally take DC power to run. But either way, you don't need current to send power through a, like that bridge rectifier over there. If you're on Twitch TV, you'll be able to see what it is that I'm talking about. Right back in there is a bridge rectifier. And I'm actually only using a couple legs on that thing right there. As far as the AC input. But either way, because I'm only pulsing this with a 5-volt USB charger, which they say this output, without it being under load, is 9 volts AC, well, then that's pulsing the primary, which is pulsing the secondary, and it's ramping that voltage up and sending down through a bank of AC run capacitors. Actually, start capacitors is what those are. But because I'm not pushing current through them, I don't have to worry about them getting hot. I don't have to worry about destroying them. And so that the voltage pressure is going into that rectifier, and it's being changed to a DC wave to go through and charge up my storage bank, which are these three over here in series with each other. And right now, they're sitting at 87 volts, right? And all my voltages that I got so far, because I'm also using this to charge up a lead-acid battery. So I've got 8.53 on the lead-acid battery, and I've got this, now I've added this big, huge boost cap bank that my friend Rich sent me for research purposes, and I'm charging up a another bank back here, another super cap bank that he also sent me. All these even the smaller banks down here, these super capacitors down here, are all being charged up by the voltage pressure that's coming up out of those deals. It's all going downstream. It's looking for the least path of resistance, and so it'll find an empty space and it'll fill it up. Well, on this bank right here, I've got 7.58 volts, and I've got 8.62 volts on this one over here. I've got 8.59 on that one right there. And in the background on the car audio capacitors that I've got back there, those are sitting at 8.61 volts. So if you take up all these voltages, these are after whatever's left over that it doesn't require to run that load or to charge that battery down there. That's what's left over. And that's another thing that people don't seem to get when it comes down to recharging batteries and storage banks and such like that, is that what you're seeing on that voltmeter, that's what's left over after whatever it is that you're trying to run is running. That's the extra voltage that's there. That's available. You could actually put another load with the equivalence of whatever you see on there, and you'll watch those numbers get smaller. But nonetheless, there it is right there in front of you. So if you actually start doing the calculations of what I've got stored and what I've got in surplus throughout all these different systems, then you'll understand what it is that I'm trying to get at. But capacitor technology is ridiculously simple. Once you understand the simples of capacitors, like you got two plates, a positive and a negative plate, and then you got what's called a dielectric, which is a non-conductive material, in the middle. And the strength of that dielectric basically is that, under what voltage will it break down and basically short across the plates and short the capacitor out, basically destroying the capacitor. Now you got a real short. But even after you burnt a hole in that thing, like right through the dielectric, that capacitor is still capable of storing some power, just not near the amount, because the breakover voltage, the breakdown voltage of the dielectric, when you have a hole burnt through that dielectric, you still got some atmosphere in between there that you have to overcome that in order to be able to short those plates out. So not near as the amount of voltage pressure that you could store in there now, because you've already broke through the dielectric, making a short path to the other side, but you still can store some power in there. But once you understand about that, the dielectric is the non-conductive material that's in between the two plates, and you're basically charging these plates up, and one or the other plate is going to have a higher amount of electrons on it than the opposite side, and nature's going to want to balance this out. Well, you've got to provide a path for nature to actually balance that out, and then once you provide a path like shorting across with a screwdriver across the capacitor or something like that, if you're looking on Twitch, I'm going to use this wooden rod, but I'm not really going to do it. But you short across those terminals, and that allows that path to go straight across, and those plates will balance themselves out. They'll have the same amount of electrons on each side, so they're back to their natural state. Real simple, basic science. Once you understand that kind of terminology, so to speak, or how I just explained it, capacitors are ridiculously simple. And so what my goal is with what I'm trying to share with you today about energy storage is I'm working on a storage system that is going to be ridiculously easy to build, most effective, the highest dielectric involved in the deal, which is glass, and be able to withstand a lot of current, so that there's no way that you can actually burn this thing up. There's no way you can blow it up unless you really, seriously put some ridiculous amount of power to it, and you finally reach the breakdown of the glass and shorted across the other side. So you could store a heck of a lot of voltage pressure in the right type of capacitor. All these capacitors, like I mentioned earlier, you got AC capacitors, you got AC start, run capacitors, AC start capacitors. All of them have their different, little quirks to them, so to speak. So if you understand what each one of them for, now you could use it for a purpose inside there. Like I'm using these AC start capacitors because they're used to actually start electric motors. And in a normal circuit, you're not going to leave these full time in the circuit because they will get hot from the current and they will destroy themselves. the dielectrics inside of them will break down, or they'll overpressurize and explode. You don't want that. So what I'm doing with them is I'm not only running them more efficiently, but I'm running them cooler by just putting voltage to it with minimum or zero current. I mean, there might be on a micro scale, there might be some current involved, but for the most part, what you're talking about is mostly voltage alone, and it's sending that AC wave through those right there. Well, those are able to store a little bit of power, and it can pack a punch. That's why the AC start capacitor is my choice for this particular one. And I've got five of these AC start capacitors on each output, one on the ground side of the transformer and one on the high voltage side. So you know, I basically made a set of railroad tracks for that energy to go down into each one of these, fill that bank up, and by the time it gets to the bridge rectifier, it packs a punch and it puts a little bit more power through that bridge rectifier. But keep in mind, once again, heat is our enemy when we're talking about running these things, because we don't want any losses in the system. And as long as I've been running this, the DDS signal generator is not getting hot. The only heat involved in this deal is the basically the standard or conventional way of running electricity is the transformer in the 5 volt USB charger and the transformer in the 9 volt AC adapter, because those have a primary in them, and those primaries are connected to the grid, and the grid is putting more power to that primary than that primary actually needs to run. Now, it's only putting it in at a stage where it might only get warm, you know, for a while, then eventually when the coating on the wires starts to break down, it might short a couple of the turns in it and make it get a little hotter each time, and eventually it'll just up and fail from the thermal breakdown of it. But in the meantime, at 60 hertz, at 114 volts is what it's showing up there on the deal right now, it's tolerable. It can tolerate that heat. Now, if you had a way to disperse that heat in order to keep that transformer from ever reaching its thermal breakdown, it will never fail. And so if in between that transformer I had a buffer such as a storage bank that would allow it to store power before it ever even got to that, and that transformer would only accept the amount of power needed, but all the power between the wall adapter and the transformer inside that AC adapter, well, that would give that extra energy that thing cannot use a place to go until it's needed for that deal. So the amount of power that's coming out of there, if you know the exact amount of power that's coming out of there per second or minute or even hour or whatever, and the amount of power that transformer actually needs to use, then that would tell you how large of a storage bank, a buffer, that you would need to put in between that in order so that storage bank or buffer can never get full. And it just stays just full enough to be able to allow the pressure, the voltage, to move forward and fill that up with enough current to actually run that. But therefore, now the difference is that transformer will not get hot. See, that's the key in this whole entire deal. We can guide that energy to wherever we want to go, but we're cramming too much power to the devices that we want to run, and it's not needed. It's not necessary to do that. And that's what the mainstream industry's got to get figured out. Otherwise, they're just going to continue to keep on doing the same thing over and over, and you know, trying to figure out a way to store more power to feed a device that's basically running incredibly inefficient because of the way that it's designed. You know, most of our devices are designed really well, all right, as far as engineered wise. But what they're not designed to is to withstand too much power coming to them. I mean, you plug in an electric fan, it works fine, all right? But then while that electric fan's running, it's actually generating heat through the transformer. That heat then in turn transfers over into the windings of the primary, and then, you know, starts to get hot. Well, eventually that heat will transfer, you know, throughout the entire device, and before too long, now because of the way that the bearings inside the, you know, rotors going, the shaft of the rotor, it's going to build up friction, it's going to build up heat, and it's going to eventually, you know, reach its thermal breakdown and begin to fail. But if you had those bearings constantly being cooled and lubricated, they'd never fail. If you had that transformer constantly being cooled and no power, not trying to shove too much power to it, it would never reach its thermal breakdown, and therefore it would never fail. So with that said, when you're grinding that energy where you want it to go, and you're doing it in a manner by which you're not trying to give any given device too much current, it's current that produces the heat, because the current meets the resistance. It's voltage that is the pressure that gets the work done. When you understand that, then all you need is a lot of voltage pressure. Just like that example, what I said, if you have a air tank and you only got 35 PSI and you need 35 PSI in a tire, you're only going to get half of that to transfer over. It's going to balance itself out, with the exception of maybe the case that that tire is also connected to a car which has downforce pressure, and it might only allow you to get 15 pounds of pressure into that before it basically balances itself out. So those are things to take in consideration. Well, when you got a storage demand that you need to meet, then if you have a higher amount of pressure in that air tank than you actually need in that tire, so you got 65 PSI up in the air tank and you only need 35, that's no problem. You can meet that demand and you can air that tire up and everything will work fine. It's the exact same concept when you're talking about electricity. It's doing the exact same job. So when we look at everything that I just mentioned right there, our storage capabilities right now are off the scale. We have technologies available to us, ridiculously simple solutions that would be cheap and extremely efficient. There's tons of sand all over the planet, all right? Sand is what they make glass out of. So there's tons of sand. You'll never run out of glass, so you can make really heavy-duty glass capacitors. All you need is your metal plates. Aluminum seems to be a really good one. Copper would be another really good one. Maybe a combination of the two, and maybe coolant inside there like they use in transformers or pig poles or whatever you call them that's up there on the power pole. Those are actually capacitors and step-down transformers all in one shot. Now, it depends on who you ask, they'll tell you different. I don't care what they say, but if you look at watching how they actually put these things together, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. It's ridiculously simple. I gotta take a drink of my coffee. And so with that said, let's go into this next podcast here.
How can you tell that storage has become a hot topic? For those that read The Economist, the lead article in August 12, 2017's edition, entitled Electrifying Everything, was devoted to batteries, with projections of massive investments and rapidly falling costs. Even more telling, however, was a sold-out energy conference recently organised in San Diego. As described in an article in the San Diego Union Tribune, the event, the fifth in the series, was attended by over 2,000 delegates and ran out of space for exhibitors eager to showcase their latest products. A couple of years ago, the paper reported, the same event at the same venue struggled to attract 400 attendees, with plenty of space left unused. Why the rising interest in energy storage? Well, two obvious reasons come to mind. Firstly, with so much variable renewable generation coming online virtually everywhere, the need to store the excess output is already large and rapidly growing. Second, As the technology to store ever larger amounts of energy improves and costs fall with massive investments and large economies of scale, there will be even more demand for storage, utility scale as well as distributed. There is so much money being ploughed into energy storage and so much talent associated with it that the evolution of storage costs are likely to follow a similar path to solar PV, with the exception that, by all indications, this time round the technology improvements and falling costs will be much more dramatic and expected to happen much faster. Solar PVs, after all, were known for many decades, though were used sparingly in the 1960s and 70s due to high costs. Only when prices began to fall dramatically in the 1980s did demand take off. Distributed solar PV, the type now commonly found on many roofs around the world, was exorbitantly expensive in the 1980s and 1990s, limiting their mass appeal. Little demand, of course, meant little investment, which in turn meant little demand. That equation changed dramatically in the 2000s, as China began massive investments in the upstream infrastructure, which resulted in equally massive drops in price. Just like with solar PV, batteries and storage technologies, of course, have been known about for a very long time. But so far have been used in mainly high-value-added applications. Think of the battery in your mobile phone or camera, for example. But if the lessons of solar PV is any indication, the price of storage technologies, not one, but a myriad of technologies, is now on the brink of plunging and will give rise to more applications and greater demand. How can we be so sure, however? Well, one indicator, as The Economist explains, is the ranks of giant companies, Panasonic, LG, BYD, Samsung, and a host of others, that are making massive investments to expand energy storage capacity, mostly in batteries, but also in a myriad of other technologies, from supercapacitors to pumped hydro. How likely is it storage costs will fall? Well, the experts who follow storage at Nature Energy reckon the costs of lithium-ion batteries, take an example, will drop from $10,000 per kilowatt hour we saw in the 1990s to less than 100 kilowatt hours by 2019. The indicators that storage is moving mainstream as prices fall are everywhere. In early August 2017, IKEA announced it was expanding its solar homes partnership with London-based SolarCity, by offering energy storage to its customers in the UK. The collaboration will see IKEA offering home solar battery storage packages starting at just shy of £7,000, or just under $10,000, and also offer a retrofitting battery package that starts at just £5,000, or just a shade over $6,500. What's most exciting is that IKEA's advances in the market is likely to be just the start. Distributed storage promises to get crowded, and others are set to enter the market in 2018. All told, the storage market could generate as much as $40 billion in investments by 2024, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Bloomberg says the size of the energy storage market will grow exponentially from around 790 megawatts this year to as much as 45 gigawatts in 7 years, driven almost exclusively by the dire need of electricity grid to cope with the rise of variable renewable generation. The opportunities for energy storage are truly global. Let's take the example of Germany and China. Bloomberg estimates that roughly 4% of all wind energy generated in Germany is simply given away at negative prices. And in China, the situation arguably is even more pressing, since there's no way to get rid of the excess renewable generation but to curtail. It has been estimated that China curtails as much as 17% of its renewable generation, simply for a lack of adequate transmission capacity. Figures like this make it abundantly clear why storage is going to be the next big game changer in electricity markets around the world. How much, how soon, and at what cost, of course, can be debated. But there can be little doubt about the trend any longer.
So, with that said, in the significance of all the finances talked about, and basically all the different ways to store energy, look, I could see a day when you could actually turn your entire house into one massive storage bank. With all the different types of materials and understanding how simple a capacitor really is, how simple a battery, it doesn't matter what type of battery, whether it's a nickel cadmium or lithium or nickel metal hydride or alkaline, all these different types of batteries, even the lead acid battery, it doesn't matter. Once you understand how simple those two devices are right there, then you could start thinking creatively way outside the box of the conventional means and understand how ridiculously simple it would be to take existing materials that already we already have available and take those materials and start to engineer new products like aluminum siding on your house could be a massive storage bank. You wouldn't think about, doing that. Oh, wouldn't you touch your house and get shocked? No, because you're not going to be touching both sides of the doggone aluminum siding at the same time unless you're trying to install something. But there's safety measures could be actually put into place before you did that. I mean, that's way down the line. But even to that extent, you can insulate those those deals where even if you did handle, aluminum siding that would end up being a capacitor for your house, which is a part of the storage bank for your house, there's no problem there. So, it's all about how far you want to take these ideas. That's the biggest key right there. How far do you actually want to take it? Now, this next podcast, this guy's talking about, why it is that we don't need to worry about, energy storage.
Thank you so much for being here.
Solar power is scaling up faster than cell phones. For 6 years running, half the world's additions of electric generating capacity have been renewable, and the fastest growing parts have been the modular mass-produced renewables like solar and wind power. In each of the past 3 years, they've added over 80 billion watts and won $250 billion of private investment. So America now has more solar jobs than we have coal or steel jobs. China last year added more solar power than the United States has. And the year before, China got more electricity from wind power than from nuclear power. Nuclear and coal plants prospects are fading worldwide because wind and solar power are cheaper and can also make grids resilient, preventing cascading blackouts. But these modern renewables also scale up in a fundamentally different way. Traditionally, we built giant cathedral-like power plants, each costing billions of dollars and taking many years to license and build. But now each year you can build a factory that produces each year thereafter enough solar cells to generate each year thereafter as much electricity as your cathedral ultimately will. So solar output scales up incredibly quickly. Mass-producing solar and wind equipment makes it cheaper, so it grows faster. So it gets cheaper, so it grows faster. In 20 states today, entrepreneurs will put solar power on your roof with no money down and beat your utility bill, and soon they'll offer cash back. Yet many people still claim that solar cells and wind power are too variable to produce much electricity reliably, because we can't cheaply store huge amounts for when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow. That's a myth. We do not need a storage breakthrough. We do not need supposedly 24/7 baseload coal and nuclear power plants to keep the lights on. And here's why. First, variable does not mean unpredictable. We can predict solar and wind power at least as accurately as demand. In this stormy winter month, forecast output from all the French wind farms almost exactly matched their actual output a day later. But also, secondly, we built the electric grid because no kind of power plant is 24/7. They all break. Those giant power plants are shut down about 10 or 12% of the time, losing a billion watts, maybe in milliseconds, often for weeks or months, often without warning. The grid handles this intermittence by backing up failed plants with working plants. In exactly the same way, but often at lower cost, the grid can manage the forecastable variation of solar and wind power by combining them with renewables in other places or of other kinds. So let me show you how this can work. For example, the isolated Texas grid's summer electric loads can get much smaller and less peaky with more efficient use, profitably. Now, combining 86% wind and solar power with 14% other dispatchable renewables creates surpluses that can charge up ice storage, air conditioners, and electric cars. and then recovering that distributed storage when needed and filling the last gaps with unobtrusively flexible demand can then deliver 100% renewable electricity every hour of the year with only 5% left over. Using such choreography, some European countries, without adding bulk storage, are already delivering 25 to 58% renewable electricity, far more reliable than America's. Iowa and South Dakota as well are over one-fourth wind-powered today. So they in Europe have already far transcended renewable power's supposed reliability limits. Whatever exists is possible. The National Renewable Energy Lab has also choreographed reliable 80 or 90% renewable electricity for the lower 48 United States. Bottom line, bulk electricity storage and fossil fuel backup are the costliest ways to make the grid more flexible, so we would use them last, not first. A breakthrough in cheap bulk storage would be helpful, but not vital. We needn't wait for it, and the market isn't waiting. Only the myth holds us back. Thank you.
All right, and so what he said, that's correct. What we, each one of our generators that we got, if you got a gasoline generator at home, even your alternator in your car, those things are capable of producing so much more power than you could imagine. And if you use that power properly, you can not only store it, but have plenty of power on demand. You'd be surprised at what one little 2,500-watt generator or 40-watt solar panel was actually capable of if used properly. The example that I try to give to people is that, you know, this deal that I got going on right here, right now, in the time that I've been talking on this radio show, I've been reading out voltages every now and then. I'm using a 5-volt DDS signal generator to pulse a transformer, to pulse some AC start capacitor to store power, run that AC wave through a bridge rectifier, store power into regular DC capacitors. Right now, I'm setting at 87.3 volts in that DC capacitor. That's 87.3 volts of stored pressure inside there. So if I have a 12 volt tire, so to speak, to fill up, I got more than enough pressure to fill that 12 volt tire up. Now, on the, as far as my my other voltages I got right down here, which is the battery voltage that have been charging up, it's at 8.94 and rising. I got this one over here is at 7.57, and that might be because it's being bled off by this parasitic load that I've got set up. Anyway, I got a small bank of the supercapacitors capable of about 11.5 volts, and then I got two smaller ones down here on the bottom capable of 11.5 volts apiece. And so I got 8.98 and rising on that one. I've got 9 volts on that one. 8.98 on the two audio ones in the back. So there's it's actually showing on the capacitors themselves that they got 9 volts of power stored in them. So energy storage, no problem. We got that licked as well. It's just a matter of whether or not people actually want to, you know, step up to the plate and start doing things the right way. But your average AC generator, it'll put out a whole lot more power than you could possibly imagine. If you understand how to take that current, instead of using the current to run your appliances right straight out of the gate, you put a buffer in between there, and you use that buffer to run some transformers that you're going to take that voltage current, and you're going to ramp it up as high as you can voltage-wise. All right, and then you're going to stick it into a storage bank. Well, that storage bank, because high voltage, higher frequency, if it's made out of the proper materials, the best dielectric is glass, then that means it can withstand all that power that you're going to put in there without burning a hole through the dielectric and shorting those plates out. Therefore, you'll have a massive amount of pressure stored in there. when you want to run your load or whatever, the power is already there to push towards that load. And once that power is trying to go through that load, it's going to back up. It's going to give you back the current that you needed in order to run that. I've already proven this multiple times by showing different scenarios where you can actually run, you know, electric motors that will require current in order to run. But we only did it using voltage and then stored that pressure and then pushed it back into current again so that... When it's like if you're squirting a garden hose inside of a pipe, one of the end of the pipe is capped off, you're going to start filling that pipe up, all right? And eventually you're going to have a lot of pressure in there. It's going to end up backing up back out the other side. If you can put enough pressure through that pipe fast enough that on the other side, if it meets any kind of resistance whatsoever, it's going to start backing up in that pipe. And eventually the whole volume of that pipe will be filled up and it'll be moving forward in the form of current. So you can get your current back. That's not the problem. This is the reason why I kept telling everybody, at this stage in the game, I don't care about current watts and amps. I don't care about all that right now. What I'm trying to do is show people how to move energy more efficiently and be able to use that energy more efficiently. When you're shoving power to any device, if you haven't got no place for it to go but between the input device or the output device of the device, the generator or the load that you want to run off of it, in this case it's a DBS signal generator and a microwave oven transformer. If I ain't got nowhere for that power to go, it will bounce back and forth and it'll cause both the driver force and the load itself to start generating heat from the resistance. So I added an AC capacitor in there because I know the amount of voltage is actually coming out of the pulse, the 60 hertz square wave. It's only coming out at about 9 volts, and that capacitor is capable of holding several hundred volts. There's a lot of room for it to slow that and basically build a storage pool for the energy while it's waiting to pulse that transformer off and on, which then in turn pulses the primary. So that same concept in between each stage is what is the reason why that transformer is able to run as long as it does without getting hot. The bridge rectifier is able to run as long as it does while getting hot. None of the loads are getting hot. And everything is staying cool, so that means it's running incredibly efficient. When you want to run a circuit, like say the one that I posted in the deal, I'll actually get a copy of the link. I'll have to look it up here while I'm talking. But I'll actually repost a diagram. And if you go there, I made a video about this as well. But I'll actually repost a picture of the diagram, so that you can take a peek at it, and if you want, try to replicate it. Let me see if I can get to the right one. I want to make sure I get the right one, because one of them might not be the right size. One of them might be too small. And I want you to be able to see it without having to zoom it in. But either way, If you don't just stop at looking at this thing as, well, you know, it's not going to run my house, and you actually look into testing it, then you might find out what I'm talking about. It makes a lot more sense than it might sound at this point in time. But let me see if I can find the doggone thing. I'm scrolling down here. I'm going to post it in all the different chat rooms. Okay, there it is. View image. Alright, this is a ridiculously simple circuit, and even it can be improved on. Select all, copy. Alright, I'm going to throw it in the super chat. If you're listening in on a different network and want to share it over to your network, have somebody jump over there and grab this and take a peek at it and try to replicate this. And there are improvements that can be made on this. Since I put the video out about it and did the live stream about it, I've found that there's improvements that actually could be made, you know, to make it even better. Such as on the flyback driver, you can actually take away some of the heat from the driver, the little 555 timer on the driver circuit by putting an electric motor in there to drain away some of that current, because you don't need that much current going to that IRF-Z44 MOSFET, and also work with an IRF-3205 MOSFET. You can buy a high voltage circuit similar to what I'm doing right here on eBay pretty doggone cheap, a couple bucks. And if you understand that that transistor or that MOSFET is going to get hot, the key to be able to run this long time is to keep that MOSFET cool. There's ways by to put really heavy duty heat sink on that thing so that you can run this forever and it won't transfer enough heat to make that MOSFET reach its thermal breakdown point. It won't fail on you. So I got it posted in over on the Super Chat Room. I'm going to post it over on Twitch as well, so that if you happen to drop in on this video, that you'll be able to see what it is that I'm talking about. But until you try it, it's just an idea. But once you try it and you see what it is that I'm saying, and it does what I tell you that it's going to do, then you can take it to the next level. You can take this design, and I'm going to post it over here in People for People chat over there on Skype so that they can grab it over there. And I'll post it in the Knights of the Round Table, and then I'll post it in the Mad Science. Sorry about that. That's terrible. This is why it's always good to have somebody else call in. So if you happen to be listening and you want to call in and join, that helps to break up the monotony. I'm sitting here juggling. I'm duct tape and baling wire and trying to pass links and give everybody all the information necessary, to be able to get this information so they can, benefit from it. Anyway, looking back at that circuit, when you're running this circuit right here, between the doggone primary on there that has the center tap, you got a lot of power bouncing back and forth through there. It doesn't need that much power bouncing back and forth there. It doesn't need that much current bouncing back and forth there. So if you can keep that MOSFET cool, and if you can guide some of that current away from it, then that little 555 timer that you see on that little driver deal, it won't get hot and fail. After it gets to a certain temperature, that thing will shut off. You'll watch the decrease in the output voltage on there. And so you don't want it to ever get hot. You want it to run cool. And you can adjust this thing where it's just barely lighting up the neon bulb and such. And then you'll see what I'm talking about. When you crank it up all the way and see how bright that neon bulb will get, the harder you run this, the cooler you need to keep these devices. But this particular DC motor controller, speed controller, can actually be replaced by a potentiometer, or some sort of variac. That only basically a variac and a potentiometer, and even this DC motor controller, they all do the same job pretty much, as they reduce the input current to the device so that it's not using too much power. You can speed things up and slow them down. Well, a potentiometer would do the same thing, but on the power side of it, you still probably get a little bit of heat from the potentiometer, but it might be able to withstand more heat if you keep that potentiometer cool. The same thing applies. Keeping everything cool is the key in order to make it really efficient. And could be that even the resistor that I used in this particular deal, which is also color-coded, and I have a link out there that I can share with you, or you can Google it up for color codes for, there's a website out there, DigiKey. I think Bart posted it in the chat room last Mad Science show, so people can click on it and you can take any resistor and you can find out what its numbers are on it by the color code that's on there. This one is gold, red, green, and brown. So with that knowledge, you know what type of resistor. But it could be very well the case that you can use a smaller resistor, which may even make the MOSFET run a little bit cooler because it's not meeting as much resistance. It's just to keep that voltage spike from coming back and overloading the part and burning it up, or from one direction or another, it slows down the current so that it won't burn something up. But between that little area right there, that's going to cause it to generate heat, because the voltage backing up in the resistor and the voltage backing up in the MOSFET is causing it to, the current backing up back and forth between that is causing it to get hot. And so if you can guide some of that power away from that, then you got just enough to run it, but not enough to get it hot. And so you can keep it cool that way. That's the key in order to be able to get your generators to be able to loop themselves, you know, because when you're trying to fight with all the laws of physics, the doggone, between the eddy currents and the back EMF and the lens effect. Also, there are people out there who understand that when you're guiding the electrical current in a direction, and then you turn on a load such as a light bulb, that energy goes out of that generator into that light bulb, right back into that generator, and runs head on into the direction of the current flow that you're trying to get the electricity out. And so when that happens, it produces a second field that starts to act as a brake on the armature, slowing that generator down. But if you can guide that electricity that you want out, and if it does go back into the generator, it goes back in the same direction as the generator is actually turning. Now you can actually get an electrical assist with that generator so that it's not working hard and it won't get that effect like basically those two fields trying to fight with each other, because they're running side by side. They're not going to oppose one another. And this is the key to everything that I've been talking about. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about plasma technology or whatever. All we're doing is taking the energy and we're moving it from one place to the next. We're either speeding it up, or we're slowing it down, or we're doing something, we're storing it, we're putting pressure, we've got parts that are used as valves and switches and guiding energy to where we want it to go when we want it to go there, so that you know, we can get work done. But we can get that work done incredibly efficient if we understand the basics of how all this stuff actually works, what is actually going on, what electricity really is. Forget all the doggone school books and all that kind of stuff, to the extent where you don't sit there and let that be a crutch to not move any further, to not research any deeper into what the possibilities are. Take this one little circuit right here and see how far that you can actually take it. There's temperature thermometers out there, some laser temperature thermometers, where you can actually run this thing at its lowest, run it at its highest, raise the temperature up, and then find creative ways on how you can actually keep that circuit cool so that it can run its maximum constantly without ever getting it to the point where it reaches its thermal breakdown. All these parts will fail when they reach their thermal breakdown. And when that energy starts to back up and it starts bouncing back and forth between the load and the generator, it's going to cause both sides to get hot. It's going to cause both sides to have to work harder, and eventually something's going to fail. But we have technologies available such as capacitors, where you can make a big pool of energy, send all that energy off in one direction, and when that bank starts to get too much power to it and it's going to start backing up again, you can turn on another load and drain that energy away from it. So as long as the energy is moving away from that device, but you still have enough pressure, voltage pressure, in order to run whatever device it is that you're trying to run, everything's going to last longer. That's the whole key. The energy storage capabilities that we got are perfectly adequate. They're just not being used properly. It's not that we don't have enough power to run all our stuff. It's that we're doing it in the most inefficient manner possible, and we're causing damage to our appliances, or even our electric generators. When we're pumping energy to these electric generators, you know, we're making them work too hard, which transfers back to the prime mover, which, you know, like an all-electric generator would be the battery, and you can't figure out why you can't get that battery to recharge on demand, because of the way that that battery is designed. It's not designed to accept a power as rapidly as a capacitor is. That battery, you know, you have to take some current and some amperage and be able to cram that energy into that battery because of the way that it's designed. It's basically like hitting a brick wall. But with voltage, you don't have that resistance. You can charge a battery with voltage. I've already proven this by what I've done here on this experiment that you're looking at on Twitch. This energy, when it's pressurized in the main bank, and it starts pushing that pressure outward, gradually filling up all these other different size capacitors and bleeding off into that battery, that battery starts to accept that voltage and it starts to become charged up. So right now I'm sitting at 9.12 volts on the battery. I got 7.58 on another one. I got 9.16 on another one. I got 9.19 on another one. 9.17 on another one. I got 9.2 on both of the AC or the audio car audio capacitor banks, and I got 87.4 volts of stored pressure in the system as we speak. And so, knowing that those two car audio capacitors, those normally run around 12 volts, all right? So I can push at least 12 volts to those. I ain't got no problem with them. I'm not going to damage the circuitry in there because it's already connected to the system. It's not going to be a sudden surge of power. So I just kicked over to 9.3 on one of them, but I'm up to that much power in there, and I know that I got a long ways that I can go before I actually destroy that. So all these loads that I'm running, including this battery, if I tried to cram too much power to that battery at one time, I could blow it up as well. I could blow up a capacitor if I try to cram too much current through there. But I'm not using current. I'm using voltage pressure to move the power forward, and it's charging up all these systems that we're talking about. So with that said, that DDS signal generator only putting out maybe a maximum of 9 volts while it's under a load, and you add up every bit of what I just mentioned here, I've got a parasitic load that is designed specifically to drain power off of it while it's charging. It's under a load. The battery itself is part of the load because it's actually being charged. At some point, the battery no longer becomes part of the load because when it gets charged up, then it actually will push pressure back into the capacitors and keep them. And now I'm ready to go. I can kick on the load behind me, and I can charge it up as well. Drain that power down, and when that power gets down to a certain predetermined level, a low voltage circuit will actually trip it and turn the load off and then charge it back up again. So everything that I've been talking about, it doesn't have to run continuously. So when you're running the load, it only needs so much power. You run that load, it's got its own buffer system, so it's got storage banks, so even when this power supply isn't on, it's still got enough to run it for a while, and then when that voltage gets low, I kick the charging system back on. So intermittently, we're being able to take and turn these power on and off and use them as we need it so that we can get work done on demand, and that's the key to this whole entire thing. An electric generator, an all-electric generator, perfectly designed, will loop itself because it has more than enough power necessary to run that. It's just that when you go by the standard way of doing things, you got all these losses in the system. And all these losses factor into it starts to drain power off because, number one, the system's fighting itself all along, trying to get the power that you want to use to do the work, and then when it comes down to the actual trying to put the energy back into the battery, you can't do it because you can't put the power in there fast enough because the battery will not accept the power fast enough. But we have circuitry where you can now take and switch these batteries back and forth. One is on the load, one is on a charge. Then whenever you get it to the point where you want it to flip over, it drops down 11 volts on the run one. It automatically swaps the battery out for the fresh battery and goes back and forth. So never the load and the battery are on the same exact time. You're not charging the battery while you're using the battery. You're charging the battery when you're not using the battery. And that's why you always have a fresh one in line. They're flipping back and forth. The capacitor storage is assisted by keeping a steady flow constant because it's always under pressure. And that pressure is out helping to charge the battery banks up. The amount of power that's actually coming out of the generator itself, it will give you more than enough power to run small loads that run circuitry that will ramp your voltage way up. It'll drop your current way down. It'll ramp your voltage way up. It'll pressurize all these systems together. Let's see what's going on. I got there. We're good. I just talked too long. But it will put all the power necessary into storage, and then when you want to run more voltage out than you get access, because one small load on a generator is not going to cause it to buck down far enough to actually drain your batteries too fast. And so whenever you want to bring your power back around and loop it into your system, you're taking it into a system that is not trying to run head on into the energy that you're trying to use on the way out. That's the same thing on the generator. When you're putting that power, when you put it under a load and that energy comes right back in and runs head on into the same magnetic field you're trying to pull power off of, that's what's slowing everything down. That's where the losses come in. That's where running too much current, the heat losses in there. Any friction losses, all these can be addressed by redesigning that doggone system to basically allow that energy to flow smoothly. That's what you see if you're sitting here on Twitch and you're looking at this system right here. You're seeing how I'm guiding this energy to where I want it to go, but I'm not allowing this energy to back up on any of the driver forces, which would be the signal generator, then after the transformer. The signal generator is sending power to the transformer, which is sending power to the secondary, and all that power is moving forward, and it never has the opportunity to back up. The energy that is in that those start capacitors are not backing up into the secondary, slowing anything down. There's not meeting any resistance at the doggone bridge rectifier, so that energy is able to move forward and dump into the storage bank, which are the large capacitors that are all running series. And so I'm sitting at 87.4 volts on that of stored pressure. That stored pressure is still rising while under a load. It's still pushing power down, bringing my battery level up to 9.13, getting ready to 9.14 down here in this lower left corner. There's a couple old junky batteries in the floor that's being charged up by all this right here. And so this will probably be obnoxious, but I'm going to flip this switch behind me and you'll start hearing this system behind me energize. And so when that starts to energize, you can start watching the voltages go back down a little bit. I hope you can hear that on the radio, and I hope you can hear it on Twitch as well. But the system behind me basically is coming alive. Let me see what it is I'm looking at here. Alright, there we go. That system up there is coming alive. That takes a lot of power to run that system right there. All right, And you see where all my voltages are standing on the deal. I'm turning that system up there behind me off. So I flip that switch. Now, you'll see as the voltages start to, let me get everything back together here. I got everything out of whack now. You'll see as all the voltages start to rise again. And I didn't use that much power out of that storage bank in order to be able to do that. I just used it intermittently, and that's all I have to do through this entire deal is use this power intermittently to put whatever power is necessary into the bank in order to do the job that I want done. So if you're watching in over there on Twitch, you probably got a bird's eye view of what I'm trying to say. I'm hoping I'm explaining it on the radio just as well as I am on Twitch. But check out that diagram. You could replace the PWM 180-1803B motor DC motor controller with a potentiometer or a variac of some sort, something to regulate the power from your battery so that you're only putting a little bit of power at a time. That'll raise and lower the speed of that MOSFET to produce the high voltage on the other side. So I'm actually going to have to get up here and short this thing out here in a minute, or it's going to drive me insane. But I've got a couple more links of a couple more podcasts, and they're also talking about pretty much the same thing. I'll post both of them in the chat room, one at a time, of course. But this is a two-part podcast, and there's a lot of what they say in there that I disagree with, because as far as if you listen to me long enough, you know how I feel about climate change and carbon emissions and all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, you know, if these people want to believe that our planet's heating up due to, you know, CO2 emissions, then more power to them, as long as they motivate people to actually assisting and getting free energy out to everybody so you stop getting robbed by the power company. And believe me, the power company will rob you. They have no problem robbing you. I've experienced this on multiple occasions. So with that said, I'm popping in both links, part one and two of another documentary. I might start playing a little bit of it so it'll give me something to mouth off about. But either way, if you listen to what they're trying to tell everybody out here, it's almost as if these folks are telling you how this is almost impossible, or, you know, it's not the right amount, or you're not going to be able to. I'll just play it. Alright, so let's start off with the first one, and then I might skip in and out of this thing a bit and tell you what I think about the whole scenario. Anyway, let's get over to the first one, which, let me see where we're at here. Alright, I think that was the first one. Part one.
Under your bed, in the attic, even on your mobile phone, it seems there is never enough storage. It turns out it's also true of energy, particularly sustainable energy. Hello and welcome to the programme. Now, our present energy use relies on vast storage facilities, underground reservoirs of natural gas, tankers of fuel, even water stored in hydroelectric dams. As our energy use changes, so will our energy storage options, and we may have to think about storage in a different way. Not just energy storage, but also storing byproducts of energy production, such as carbon and carbon dioxide. And when it comes to carbon, you've got to capture it before you can store it. So, ahead on the programme. Batteries, they put power in your handheld devices, but could they unlock the true potential of renewable energy? Could air provide the answer to storing power from renewables for when you really need it? is not just carbon dioxide causing environmental issues. Black carbon is too. We head to Berlin to look at a potential green solution. A journey to the land of fire and brimstone. Has carbon dioxide met its match? Now, in 2014, solar and wind energy accounted for just 4% of power generation. But by 2060, this figure is expected to rise to up to 39%. The problem is renewable energy is unpredictable and is difficult to store. Much of the energy we could generate from renewables is wasted. For example, in India's Tamil Nadu region, it's estimated that up to half of the electricity that could be produced by wind power is lost. Currently, the vast majority of electricity storage is provided by pumped storage hydropower, but other technologies are emerging. One option, battery storage, is expected to see prices drop by around 70% over the next 15 years. That could fuel a boom in the energy storage market, forecast to grow 100-fold by 2025. And if we're going to meet our climate change targets, we also need to consider carbon capture and storage. They're expected to contribute a sixth of total CO2 emission reductions by 2050. Now, AA, AAA, 9-volt, nickel metal hydride, the last decades have seen huge developments in battery technologies, meaning that they're lasting longer, they're more powerful, and they're being used in more ways than ever before. They may also be the key to harnessing one of renewable energy's biggest challenges, storing energy when it's generated and releasing it when it's really needed. We went to Chicago to find out what the future has in store for the not-so-humble battery. Mobile phones, laptops, tablets. It's the battery inside that brings them all to life. And for the last 25 years, it's relied on one type of battery in particular.
Lithium-ion has been transformative for personal electronics. It's gotten about a factor of 3 better in energy density. When it was introduced in 1991, it was already a factor of 2 better than the next best battery.
Now batteries are set to be the key to the green energy revolution, powering higher energy performance road vehicles and also to harness the true power of renewable energy. But to do that, you need the next generation of batteries.
Well, this is sort of a storage moment. So we're looking for batteries to do for transportation and the electricity grid what they've done for personal electronics, to really make a huge change in the way these systems operate.
That research is going on here at the labs of the Joint Center for Energy Storage.
One of the keys, and I'm interrupting there for a second, but one of the keys is the deal where they keep talking about batteries, you know, being the main deal right there. Folks, if you use the power properly, not only would these batteries last longer, but they would be able to regenerate as they're going down the road. There is more power coming out of these generators than you actually need in order to get the work done. It's not the fact that we don't have enough power, it's that we're not using the power properly. So designed properly, you could get that doggone car, electric vehicle, to be a rolling power plant, just the same way you could get your entire house to be a stationary power plant. There's so many different things that occur inside your house between the heat in the attic and the cold air in the basement or whatever. That wind pressure outside, the sunlight, even rain for that matter. You know, there are so many different ways to utilize the energy that's occurring in even a stationary object, because around you the atmosphere is constantly in motion. It's always something going on. There's always a lot of power happening. We think we got to have these generators pushing out a whole lot of current in order to be able to store the power necessary to do the work, but that's not the case. And between the chemistry, different types of batteries, and the capabilities of storage in those alone, we don't have a problem. We never had a problem.
Research.
This lab is basically a materials design lab, so we use lots of facilities like the Advanced Photon Source to study materials at the atomic level, learn what those structures look like, learn how they change and how they behave while a battery is working, the fundamental physics and chemistry behind the structure of a battery and how and why it behaves, try to take that information and design new materials around that information to see if we can change the characteristics and the performance of a battery, and this lab is where we make those materials.
Scientists here are banking on new materials for big advances in
One other thing, too. When you start thinking about how a lot of people will say when you turn a load on, like electric motor or a light bulb, that it's actually drawing power from that battery. That's not what's happening there. The load never draws power. It's always the energy trying to balance itself back out. It's the pressure of the battery, one plate being more charged up than the other, trying to push that energy forward so that it can balance those two plates out back to their natural state. So it's always pressure pushing forward that's actually doing the work. It's not that the load is actually pulling power from the battery. That's not what's happening. It's the pressure pushing forward that's providing the current flow that is actually doing the work. And so with that understanding right there, then now maybe you can see what it is that I'm saying about why it is that voltage is the most important portion of the deal, and that why your batteries are having to work so hard. When that when that pressure is trying to go forward, and it's meeting resistance, it's wanting to go. It's still able to go a little bit, but it's still meeting resistance. And so that transfers heat not only into the load, but it also transfers heat back through the wire and into the battery itself, causing that battery to get hot. You know, if you had a smooth, instantaneous discharge of that battery where, you know, this current could just basically go around a loop, a really large loop that could withstand all the current flow, and one tap on that battery and both of those sides of that battery would balance out equally and peacefully and not explode the battery. It's not a dead short. You're just, some sense it is a dead short, but it's a dead short that has enough space for all that energy to transfer from one side to the other rapidly. And then that's the equivalence of what a capacitor is actually doing.
Batteries for cars and the grid. A number of options go beyond lithium-ion.
So the easiest one is to replace lithium, which has a single charge on it, with magnesium, calcium, or zinc, each of which have two charges on it. That doubles the amount of energy which is stored or released. The second kind of next-generation battery would be lithium-sulfur, for example. Theoretically, can be a factor of 10 more energy-dense than lithium-ion. If you get even half of that potential, and that would be transformative. For the grid, it's going to be flow batteries. You need even more energy stored for the grid than you do for a car, and you're not so concerned about size.
Flow batteries use two chemical components dissolved in separate liquids and can store very large amounts of electrical energy, perfect for harnessing renewables.
Most of the countries have plans right now to slowly slide up their percentage of renewables. But it's a slow process, and you do it slowly so it's not too expensive. You do it where it makes sense, and you do it as technology allows. Batteries and electric vehicles will enable that, enable full utilization, and really kind of smooth out the introduction of renewable energy into the grid.
If Thomas Edison looked at the power grid today that he invented in the 1880s, he would probably pretty much recognize what he saw, but that's all about to change.
We're on the verge now of a similar kind of change in the electricity grid that we've seen in telephones. The grid of the future will not look anything like the grid of the past, and energy storage will be a critical factor in creating that grid of the future.
And before I get into any more craziness, Tesla showed everybody how to do wireless energy transfer. And everything that Ben's talking about, whenever you're pulsing these transformers, is producing waves and pushing energy forward. They actually use Tesla technology for wireless energy, wireless charging of cell phones and Wii chargers and stuff like that. They're actually producing a high voltage, high frequency wave that's coming up, and it's charging up your batteries. It's got a receiver on the other side. We've got wireless energy around us all over the place, and including the wasted energy off of the power grid, because most of the power that's coming down here, not all of that power gets to you. It actually is radiated out. It's wasted energy. It's lost in heat and such. So, you know, in order to meet the demand, they'll ramp the voltage up, they'll ramp the frequency up, they'll send it down the wire so they can move it out further. They're doing exactly what it is that I'm telling you about, but they're not doing it in the most efficient manner possible in order to be able to, you know, ensure that you got smooth power, everything stays cool. Maybe the future of power grids is that you ain't got no power lines anymore. Maybe they transmit the energy via light or whatever, you know, through fiber optics. And, you know, so all you need is that wave on the other side to do a job. It's as simple as that. I mean, sound waves can produce electricity, vibrations, you know, for like piezoelectric crystals, produce electricity, thermoelectrics, hydroelectrics, you know, a lot of you know, the steam generators, they're basically spinning magnets past coils of wire to induce a current and all that kind of jazz. Well, we now have technology where we can make solid state versions of it using transistors and MOSFETs and such, so that we can pulse those same coils without having a mechanical device involved in the deal. But if you do have a mechanical device, you're pushing a lot of power. Amazing amount of power. And if you use that power properly, you can get multitudes times more out of your power sources than you think you can. Just by understanding how that energy is used and basically finding all the hot spots in there with a thermal... Those laser thermometers or any type of thermometer where you can tell where all your heat losses are when you look at this, even thermal imaging, you can take a picture of your generator and you can find where all the hot spots are. Every single one of those hot spots is a loss of energy. If you take and monopolize on that hot spot, you take your average gasoline engine generator. Instead of heating your house with electricity from that, you circulate water through that, you know, either the water jacket on there, or if it's an air-cooled engine, you modify it so that it can take that heat away from there and then put that heat into, like, antifreeze and run that through radiator systems. You think about how whenever you're driving along in your car, and you turn the heat on, when that engine gets hot, there's a certain point where it's got so much doggone heat it can't get rid of it fast enough, and it's running you out of the doggone car. You got to turn the heater down or turn it off or roll down a window because that too much heat energy. So you can recapture all of the heat energy off of those internal combustion engines, including to the extent where now you're actually cooling the cylinder down enough to where the cylinder isn't getting too hot and it's not causing its parts to fail either. Because your oil in your engines have a certain thermal breakdown. When the viscosity becomes too low, it will actually start to, you know, get too thin, and now the heat transfer is all balancing itself out. Everything in that engine's hot, and the temperature of the weakest part gets too hot. It reaches its thermal breakdown, starts to scar the cylinders or tearing up the rings or whatever, and now you start getting metal shavings down into your oil, which is brings it around to even more problem. Even the carbon blow-by in the ring systems is also causing you problems because it's basically acting like sandpaper on your parts inside your car. We have the technologies to engineer all the things to solve every single problem in existence. When it comes to the way that we use electricity, electricity is a really good, clean, renewable energy if you use it properly. You know, and even to the extent of building your actual devices, you know, the materials, we got materials that are better than others, and we can get away from using any toxic materials and even recycling already existing materials. And as far as building capacitors, you don't necessarily have to have, you know, aluminum to build a capacitor. You could build aluminum with if you understood how the dielectric worked, with two plastic chambers that separate, you know, two deals of carbon in each side of it, you still have two plates. Now you have a capacitor made out of carbon, which will hold a lot more electrons, so have a lot more storage in there. So there's been a lot of people that's figured this stuff out. And this technology that's coming to the table. If you go look up Robert Murray Smith, he's working on some battery technology. He actually put together a battery factory. And that battery factory, he should be putting out some really good batteries at probably a reasonable price that would rival the ones that's already on the market. So let's play a little bit more of this right here.
Dr. Rebecca Ford leads research projects at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute. She was previously the Deputy Director of the Centre for Sustainability at the University of Otago in New Zealand. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us here on the programme. Why is storage such an issue of the moment?
Well, I think a big part of it is this push towards decarbonisation of our energy systems and the real need to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. And storage offers a great opportunity to do that, both in the transportation sector, where we've been hearing for quite a number of years now about the opportunities for electric vehicles, replacing fossil fuels with these batteries, as well as opportunities more recently in the electricity sector. So both on the household scale, people putting up storage systems into their home to maximise the use of solar on their roofs, as well as opportunities at the grid scale. So utilities putting in big solar big battery packs, to support integration of renewable energy.
What came first then, the technology or the need to move to renewables?
Oh, I think it's a bit of six of one, half a dozen of the other, because we've definitely seen the push for storage in the transportation space for a while, and that push has probably helped with bringing the price down. We've seen these exponential price decreases in the technologies, and that's made them competitive in the electricity markets. And as we've seen more and more renewables come online into countries like the UK, Germany, parts of the States, we're really seeing the need to try and balance these renewables, which are quite variable in their supply. They're not consistent through the day. And so there's a real need to think about how we can balance that, and storage can really support the integration of these.
Rebecca?
Once you understand what it is I've been trying to share with everybody, storage is not a problem anymore. We can and affordability is not a problem anymore. When you talk about just the simple basics of a capacitor, you got a dielectric, which is a non-conductive, and you got two conductive materials on each side of them. Don't have to be metal. They could be any conductive material. And you find the right conductive material, such as carbon, graphene technology, stuff like that, you can make really powerful storage banks, capacitors. You can also take that same concept, if you want to make a battery, you can take instead of a dielectric in the center of it, which is a non-conductive, you actually put an electrolyte in there, like pickling salt and distilled water, makes the water slightly conductive so that some energy can actually travel. You get a chemical reaction going on there. So we can make chemical batteries using the same exact technology, with exception of the materials in the center, to basically double as a battery. So you can make a combination battery capacitor that you would be charging on the capacitor side that would be bleeding over to the battery side. Capacitors will allow you to charge rapidly. It'll allow for charge and discharge rapidly so that you can actually bleed that energy over into the battery. And at a certain point, when the power is coming into the capacitor, it just skims right over the top of the battery. The battery is already topped off, and you're not draining power off of that battery. You're actually using the excess that's coming into the capacitor that the power supply, which is your generator or whatever, is pushing to the system. And so you're using that other, and now if the generator stops for any reason, you still have a storage waiting there in line that already has enough power to run your devices. So if you look out there, you will find battery capacitor hybrids out there. Those are really awesome. But the deal that I'm talking about will take and put basically in one nifty package a capacitor connected to a battery. And you're going to charge from the capacitor side because of the way that this capacitor is able to charge and discharge faster without any damage to it, unlike the battery that would be damaged by trying to charge and discharge it too fast. Some of these batteries actually develop a memory, and if they get to a certain point, they'll think that's full, and it's not. But nonetheless, getting past all that, you could actually make a triple stage to where that you had a capacitor, then a battery, and then a capacitor where it's all in one unit, and the simple of it is the battery in the middle is only there to maintain a solid voltage. Even when the generator stops, it'll charge those capacitors right back up instantaneously because they're able to charge that fast. And that will make the battery not have to work hard, and then you're pulling your load off of the capacitor portion of it. Even to the extent of having regular DC capacitors and then having those bleed over into boost capacitors or super capacitors. So it might be a quadruple stage. It'd have a capacitor, it'd have a battery, it'd have another regular DC capacitor, and then it'll have a boost capacitor bank. And so one stage to the next, but when it all said and done, the capacitors aren't actually carrying the load. It's not the battery itself that's carrying the load. It's just there as a surplus to hold the power steady. So let's hear some more of what they're saying.
Thanks for that. More from you later on in the program. First, let's take a look at another project that's transforming lives around the world.
This is where the magic happens, where the electrical energy is converted into chemical energy. Electrolyte is pumped through these cells to make that conversion, and then it's stored in storage tanks behind me. And when we want to release the energy, we pump the solution back through the cells, and the cells extract the energy and convert it into electrical energy and deliver it to the system, to the network.
Now, as we saw earlier, batteries provide a solution to storing large quantities of energy, helping us harness the power of renewables. But there are other possibilities, like an experimental solution in Birmingham. Renewable energy is on the rise and fast, but there's a catch. Even now, it's estimated 15% of renewable energy is wasted. Solar and wind isn't always generating power when you want or need it.
Storage is vital if we are to get the level of renewables that are required for a low carbon future.
So a grid scale storage device can overcome the problem. A big challenge, but Highview Power Storage say they have an environmentally friendly answer.
Well, see, these folks, they keep on saying the same doggone thing about how, like, wind power is not always going. Solar power, the sun's not always out, and so this is why you got to have storage banks. But what I've been trying to tell everybody for a long period of time was even the solar panels themselves are capable of doing so much more than what they do, and the way that we use them are so incredibly inefficient. We got the capabilities to store massive amounts of power. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But even if the sun isn't out, but the wind's blowing, or the sun and the wind isn't out, you still have thermal available to you. There's a temperature difference inside your house as opposed to outside your house. When you're running any type of heating source, you can monopolize on that. Instead of it being just a waste, you can turn around and monopolize on it because there's a temperature difference in your basement as opposed to your attic. Heat rises and cold air falls. Once you figure that out, there's your temperature difference, and you can actually use that temperature difference to do a lot of work that you couldn't possibly imagine. So what we're shooting for here on Twitch and Shazoo's Radio and Shazoo's YouTube channel is incredible efficiency. Energy is free. No ifs, ands, or buts. We're not shooting for zero point or over unity or perpetual motion. You know, even though I believe that under the right circumstances, every one of those would be possible, I'm not going there. And free energy falls under a completely different category when used with the proper terminology, because the wind doesn't cost you anything, the sun doesn't cost you anything, raging rivers don't cost you anything, thermal vents, near volcanic deals don't cost you anything. There's all different types of things going on. There's vibrations going on in the streets every time vehicles are driving up down the road. There are all kinds of things going on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There's energy flowing in some direction. Right now, as we speak, we're being bombarded by all kinds of cell phone signals and radio signals and all that kind of jazz. And even, you know, as far as energy coming from the ground and the sky and space or whatever, all of that storable energy, every single last bit of it is storable energy. Every bit of it is usable energy. The difference between the ground and every yard is 100 volts per yard or meter or whatever, up to thousands of volts way up in the air. And if you understand how that actually works, then if you separate the ground from the rod in a tower, and you have basically a spark gap in between all your cables, nothing is connected to the earth ground direct, you'll pull power right out of the doggone sky with just the radio towers that you're using, and you can store that high voltage pressure and get work done just with the towers that you got up there. So if you had a way to couple your radio towers, insulate the radio tower itself from the ground so that it's not able to transfer that voltage to the earth itself, and use some really heavy duty basically either glass or some sort of coupler that will hold those cables just as strong as if it were steel. Now, we might be talking about new futuristic style of materials, some sort of insulating device that would keep those cables sturdy like they are right now with the steel, but separated from there. You would have a massive amount of voltage that could be transferred from up hundreds of feet in the air down that could be stored as well. So just using the static electricity that's built up in the atmosphere and the ground itself, you got unlimited voltage going on. So there's all kinds of possibilities. It's just how far do you want to take it, and how much do you want to rely on you know, the system to finally give you, you know, free electricity essentially. You know, they're talking about, you know, how to save the system, how to save the power grid. That's what they're talking about. They're talking about how to improve the power grid to make it clean, renewable, under some bogus science that has to do with global warming, climate change, or climate disruption, or whatever it's going to be next week when the math don't add up. When in reality, if you understand the simple of science, what I've been trying to share with everybody, you already have it. You already have the materials necessary to build everything that it is that I've been talking about. And if you build your dream team in your communities, you can get this job done and have more than enough power to sustain all the energy needs that you've got, even with the inefficient appliances that we've got to use.
Raising air, reducing it to a volume 700 times smaller than its original size.
We start off with the charging, we pull the air in from the atmosphere, we compress that, put it through an air purification unit which strips out the moisture, it also strips out the CO2, and anything that's going to freeze and block the cycle. That then goes into an industrial refrigeration process. We compress the gas, we expand it, and we take the heat out, which we're going to use later on in the process. Once we've made the liquid air, we store it in a...
Now, did you hear that? They take and compress the gas, that it causes it to get hot, then they allows it to go through an expansion chamber rapidly, which allows it to get really cold, and they extract the heat energy out of it in the process of doing that. If you took and utilized that concept, you could have air conditioning that wouldn't even need an air compressor, just with the differences of temperatures and stuff. I'll get into that into another show, but in the meantime, as far as your internal combustion engines, if they're so worried about carbon, then hydrogen technology is where they should have went. because I've already explained this I don't know how many times at nauseam, that you can actually design a internal combustion engine that will run on pure distilled water and not violate any of the known laws of physics, none of the thermodynamics or nothing. It's just using basic science, knowing what water is made of, how water reacts under certain circumstances, and so you can use water as a fuel to generate power and recycle the whole doggone deal. Recycle your fuel, recycle the energy, and you're not burning a bunch of crud. So why I don't know. I don't understand this.
The vessel is at roughly minus 200 degrees, and this pilot facility holds enough energy to power 2,000 homes for about an hour. When we're ready to discharge the energy, we take that low-pressure liquid air, we pump it to a high pressure, normally over 100 bar. We're then utilizing the heat that we captured earlier in the process, expand the gas through a turbine, which drives this generator and exports electricity out onto the grid. Also in the process, we capture the cold, which we can later use within the refrigeration cycle.
That recycling of hot and cold makes the process more efficient, a process that could also make traditional power plants more efficient too.
Nuclear, coal, gas all work best at 100% output, so a flat output. They don't like to be turned up or down. We can utilise heat, which is often a waste product off of these other processes. So by taking heat from them, we improve the efficiency of our cycle, but also improve the efficiency of their cycle. Storage devices give you that ability to match your generation to your demand profile.
This pilot facility has been supplying the grid for 4 years, and now it's being scaled up and made faster. It's hoped that when needed, liquid air storage could generate power in less than 10 seconds.
The vision for the future is very much scaling this technology up to something really, really useful for the grid. Working towards developing the Gigaplant, which is a very large 200 megawatt plant, and that's a 1.2 gigawatt hour system, and it would power quite a large town or small city at that scale.
Liquid air storage uses tried and tested technology and can be deployed easily around the globe. It has the ability to store lots of energy for a long time cheaply, and importantly, it's a green solution too.
We're emissions neutral, so it's air in and air out, and there's no hazardous substances involved in the process at all.
Whilst there's a place for batteries, flywheels, pumped hydro, the cost for this technology, as you make it bigger and bigger, is really compelling against what else is available in the world at the moment.
So batteries, we've looked at that. Liquid air energy storage, we've looked at that. What are the other, beyond pumped hydro, solutions should we be looking at as part of the mix?
Absolutely. Well, we've seen flywheels being talked about recently and potential implementation in Hawaii. We've seen other opportunities, so the whole variety of different battery technologies as well. There's not just one, but there's multiple different sources. And of course, we shouldn't forget opportunities afforded by interconnection between different grids, so between the UK and Europe, or between grids in the US, for example, as well as opportunities around demand response, so curtailing demand to balance supply and demand rather than relying on storage.
How do we get around this issue of sudden changes in supply and demand? How do we use storage to help smooth out these peaks?
Well, there's a number of different options depending on that time frame. So I talked about demand response. Obviously, depending on the time of response you need, one technology might be better than another. So with batteries, there's a huge opportunity for that very immediate and fast response, for example, cloud coming over and stopping your solar generating. But as we start to electrify transportation and heat processes, we need to balance the grid across a whole variety of time frames. So it's not just that short term, but it's also in the longer term, so that inter-seasonal variation, in which case we may not be talking about batteries charging and discharging all the time, but maybe once or twice a year.
The question is then, what happens if the wind doesn't blow for days? What happens if the sun isn't shining for days? How does storage help us out then?
Well, different technologies can perform different functions. So when we're thinking about that real-time balancing, we're really, really concerned about having a fast response time. So how quickly can these things pick up? Obviously, with trying to provide storage for days or even across inter-seasonal timeframes, we need to think about other things. So we need to think about how much energy is available ultimately, but also how efficient is that? So what happens over time? So does that energy that we're stored, does it leak over time? Is it stable over time? And these are real opportunities where I think hydro can play a role, as can liquid air storage play a role. I don't think that we know necessarily the solution, because as we start to electrify more and more processes and we have greater needs for longer term storage, I don't think we necessarily know that the solution is there yet.
Well, that's where I disagree. The solution has been
under your bed,
there.
In the attic, even on your mobile phone. It seems there is never enough.
Yeah, you already said that, so we're not going to say that again. Anyway, as far as not being there, first off, if you're going to store power, and you understand everything I've been trying to explain here, then you use that energy in a completely different fashion than you're accustomed to, and in an incredible efficient manner, and that energy that you stored will last a very, very long time. And to rejuvenate it isn't no more than taking some of that energy and moving it where you need it to go, running small circuits that don't require a lot of load, and understanding where all the heat losses or whatever, all these things that they can basically say are losses, they no longer become losses, because you're guiding that energy around. You're using it as incredibly as efficient as possible. And proof of what I just said, if you've been watching over on Twitch, I've left this camera going, and you can see the voltages, and you know that I had turned on at one point the circuit behind me that drains out a lot of power. Well, right now the rebound voltage has came back so far. On my main storage bank, I'm holding 87.6 volts. I'm holding 9.35 on the car audio capacitors that are sitting at 9.4 volts apiece, and they're running parallel with each other. I'm holding 7.57 on this one particular bank that's actually going down into the system that's charging the battery. It's a 12 volt battery being charged, but it's back up to 9.30 volts on that. I got 9.34 volts stored in the smaller bank down here, and the big giant capacitors that you see right here, these big boost caps. And these aren't set to with the regulator circuits to the balancing circuits. I'm not worried about balancing this out. All I want to use this for is a storage tank. That's it. And nothing more, nothing less. It doesn't matter to me if some of the pressure's in one and not in the other, because I'm not trying to run this like the normal conventional deal. All I'm using it for right now is a place to push voltage pressure. So in this entire system, there is a whole lot of power available. A lot more than you think. If you actually start doing the calculations and all these voltages, minus the load, the one that's actually draining power from the system, which is that blinking light LED system. It's a parasitic load, and it's specifically designed to drain power while I'm trying to charge things to see how great of efficiency I can actually get. At the same time, it's pushing power into a lead-acid battery. And then at a certain point, like I said earlier, that lead-acid battery now becomes part of the solution, because now it starts pushing power back the other way. When everything, all the voltages rise up to their maximum, I ain't even got to the point where I'm in danger of exploding anything that, because they're already connected to the capacitors. Because I'm not going to have any sudden surge of power into the circuitry, these things will only take what they need in order to run. So everything down there, those circuit boards that's inside of those car audio capacitors, they're not in danger of being damaged by the way that I'm running this, because all I'm doing is pushing voltage pressure. I'm not pushing current. That's the whole key. So with that said, I'm going to start in on this. I got about a half an hour left. You're listening to the Mad Science Show, by the way. I got a another podcast, which is the second half of that one, and want to play some of what they said there.
Welcome back to Sustainable Energy. This time we're looking at storage. Now, earlier we looked at storing electricity, but there's another storage issue that we need to address, and that's carbon. Trees play a vital role in fighting the effects of global warming by absorbing carbon dioxide and storing it in their fibres. But it's not just CO2 that we have to worry about. Black carbon, which is essentially soot, is regarded as the second biggest contributor to global warming, up to 30% in fact, and a major health hazard in our cities. We went to meet a startup in Berlin that's come up with a solution.
Before he goes into his startup solution there, I want to say this. You go out there on YouTube and you look up rocket stove and you see how these rocket stoves actually work, where they basically suck the smoke out and reburn the smoke. It ain't no different than what's going on in your automobile, with the exception is your automobile is less efficient, because basically when whatever fuel doesn't get burned up in the intake goes down and is reburned inside the catalytic converter. And then some of that gas is circulated back up to the intake while the other portion of it goes out your exhaust. All these systems could take that type of technology and incorporate them into there, where you'd have no crud coming up out of there, because every bit of that carbon is also fuel as well. So you can reburn any carbon that would have been otherwise released out to the air. And global warming's a big scam. It's a hoax. Period.
Artificial trees.
Berlin is a famously green city. Its 440,000 trees act as the city's lungs. But in city centre locations like the city's main rail station, a new kind of tree is springing up.
We're commercialising more than 10 years of academic research about a grey biotechnology, which are specific moss cultures, as you can find in the woods. And they have the ability to literally eat up air pollution. One handful of moss has the same leaf surface as a normal tree, a tree in your street, in your city, for example. But on these leaves of the moss cultures, there are living little bacteria. And these bacteria can, once in contact, for example, with carbon or with particulated matter, they can convert this into their own biomass.
One vital function of the city tree is absorbing particulates called black carbon from the air.
Black carbon is the outcome of every single burning process you can see. If in a car, in a factory, or in a power plant, at the end of the day, you always burn certain kind of fossil fuels into energy, and there, as a result, you get black carbon. And black carbon has, as carbon dioxide, the potential to heat up our atmosphere and to accelerate the climate change.
Black carbon has over 4,000 times the warming effect of carbon dioxide. While cutting CO2 doesn't start to reduce warming until decades later, tackling black carbon has an immediate effect and could save hundreds of thousands of lives.
Black carbon has a direct impact on the people, on the health of the people, because the particles are very fine. They can go into your lungs. Your lungs are not ready for that, so they can't filter it out. So it's going into your bloodstream and causing more than 15 known very heavy health issues, for example, lung cancer and blood cancer.
These turbocharged trees suck in carbon hundreds of times more efficiently than their woodland cousins.
Every single unit improves already the air quality, of course. But to reach the required limits, you would need about, only for Berlin Center, about 100 trees. One city tree is as powerful for the leaf surface as 275 normal trees.
These units are 95% more cost-effective and 99% more space-efficient than real trees. They're solar-powered, need maintenance only 3 times a year, and are smart enough to take care of themselves.
So what we developed is in so-called IoT, an Internet of Things. There's a sensor system inside who is controlling every single moss culture in real time, so that we know how the moss cultures are feeling. They have enough water, enough nutrients, enough salt, for example. And then to also collect all the information about the unit to make it accessible for everybody, but also for our clients, for cities and for citizens.
City trees will soon be branching out in Hong Kong and Beijing. That's good news for carbon levels and for the health of 80% of urban folk who breathe in air that exceeds World Health Organization pollution levels.
Already 50% of the world's population is living in cities. So if you solve their health and sustainable problems, then you really have a global impact.
Look, what aggravates me the most about all this stuff right here, they keep using the word sustainable and all these different things, all this technology that they got going on right here, nature's already provided. But nonetheless, as long as they're trying to do that and it makes them happy, fine. But when they start trying to turn around and steal money from the general public, talking about global warming, climate change, and your carbon emissions and all this kind of craziness, the only thing that I like about the whole carbon emissions thing is the fact that, you know, it might get some people motivated into building some, some systems that, you know, basically help to clean the air out. Because we have a symbiotic relationship with plants. So we breathe out CO2, they take the carbon and they turn it into plant food. And that actually, as far as growing vegetables and all that kind of stuff, CO2 is a good tool for that as well. But nonetheless, the whole entire deal about this, folks, is if you don't pay attention to what's going on here, you're going to move into the future and you're going to have all these technologies. You're going to have free energy. But the problem is, it's going to be free energy for the corporations. It's going to be free energy for the governments. You're going to pay for it. You're going to pay for it via your taxes for their research. You're going to pay for it via your electric bills. They're going to continue the carbon scam for decades to come, talking about, you know, you can't run this machine because it's polluting or whatever, or you got to pay these taxes or whatever. It's a big scam from start to finish on how they're going to continue to control you and keep you under the thumb of the power companies forever. Now, with the technology you've already got available, I don't call this mad science for nothing. I call it mad science because it really frustrates me to see what's going on in society where you have environmentalists out there complaining and protesting about things, but never supporting the guys like myself or the gals out there that are working in alternative energy stuff. These are only people that are going to colleges and through corporations that are doing the research and development, when instead it should be a combination of they working on it over there, you're working on it in your neighborhood with your research that you're getting here or anywhere else. You build your own clean, renewable, alternative energy sources and get yourself off the power grid where you have your own community power plants so that your community is benefiting from it. And it, like these doggone hydroelectric dams and all these power plants, coal-fired power plants, you paid for them through your doggone, payments of your electric bill, when at some point your electric bill should start getting lower because you already paid off the equipment, now you're just paying for the service. So instead, you're still paying for the equipment because now you got upkeep and you got all these different taxes and extra, fees on your deal. And if they find a way to charge you extra money, they're going to take every single possible way to cause you to pay more money every time you get an electric bill, which is flat out ridiculous and it's flat out robbery. You can do the same thing. You can use the same technologies, but use them in such an incredibly efficient manner that you can benefit your communities and keep more pennies in your bucket so that you can help to fund research, more research, to make the world a better place. And then when it all comes down to where the system finally catches up to the future, there's a balance there. The people have all this knowledge, and so they don't need the system. The system just becomes, at that point, a supplementary thing. If I'm too lazy to do any work, I'll just pay the system for it. If I did some research and actually pre-plan, then I don't pay anybody. I pay myself. And that's the whole deal. And you get to that point right there with your communities. There's no waste in your communities. No plastic, no trash, Nothing that you normally see going to the dump would ever go to the dump ever again. Everything has value from that point on, including your time.
Was wir hier in der Testhalle machen, ist, wir spielen mit der Dynamik des Netzes und versuchen herauszubekommen, wie viel rotierende Masse braucht es eigentlich noch, wenn man ganz viel Wind und Sonne schon im Netz hat. Und wie viel Batterie braucht es dann, um dieses System zu stabilisieren. Das heißt, was wir hier machen, ist etwa 2050 in Europa. Wir bereiten sozusagen die Zukunft hier vor.
Now, the World Energy Council says that by 2060, renewable energy will expand massively, but fossil fuels will still make up at least 50% of energy production, so we will still need to deal with one of its byproducts, carbon dioxide. Now, at present, carbon capture and storage is expensive, energy intensive, and may not be permanent. So we travel to Europe's most sparsely populated country, which has a solution as solid as a rock.
All of Iceland's energy needs come from renewable resources, with 25% from its abundant geothermal energy. Hellisheiði geothermal power plant is the country's largest geothermal plant, producing about 12% of the country's energy production. But there is a byproduct of this otherwise benign energy form, geothermal gases, including CO2.
We actually capture the CO2 at the power plant, dissolve it in water, and inject it as sort of mineral water back into the ground. There, chemical reactions between the dissolved CO2 and the host basaltic host rock take place, turning the CO2 into minerals called carbonate. This forms when calcium from the basalt interacts with the CO2 to form these nice rocks. We don't just get these nice chunks of carbonates, we rather get these sort of tiny spots.
Here we are walking in basaltic lava field. These rocks here are essentially the same as we have 5,000 feet below us. These rocks contain all the necessary elements we need to combine with the CO2 that we just injected to form the carbonates that will be stable there for the next millions of years.
The Carbfix project started here at Iceland University under the guidance of Professor Sigurdur Gislason.
What we have here...
Before it goes any further, look, nature doesn't waste anything. Every single thing in nature gets recycled. Everything. All energies, everything. Nature has a balance. Nature will always find its balance. It will always balance itself out. Everything will be in its place that it needs to be in its place. When it comes down to CO2, those are things that nature already has pre-planned for. CO2 feeds the plants. The plants feed us. They give us fresh oxygen, we give them food. It's a symbiotic relationship. Nature's already provided an answer for all of this stuff. But nonetheless, while these folks are doing all this kind of stuff right here, if you pay attention to what they're doing, and you pay attention to basic science, and you listen to what I'm trying to tell everybody, that we already have the answers to resolve the so-called energy crisis. We've never had an energy crisis. And the reason why I call it mad science is because the mainstream science has pretty much dropped the ball. They pretty much sold their soul to the devil so they can get the money to do research. And they have to agree to the whole climate change / global warming debacle. And most of the younger people, younger generations, they believe wholeheartedly that this planet is in danger because of CO2. Now, don't get me wrong, we do pollute our environment, but we have methods by which we can assist nature to clean it up rapidly if we paid attention in school. Everything out there, from radioactive waste to oil spills and CO2 emissions, carbon monoxide emissions and everything, all these different things right there, nature has provided the means and the education on how to resolve these issues, and all we had to do was pay attention. So, if we learn from everything that we've researched all this time, and we take all these pieces of the puzzle and put them into play with each other, we can build perfect machines. Machines that do not waste anything. There's no byproduct to worry about. And, you know, any byproduct of anything is also another product, because everything that's broken down by one means or another, like when you burn firewood, you end up with multiple other products that can now be used for making multiple other products. The wood ash, it has many uses for it. Go look it up. I passed a list on one time of 10 separate uses for wood ash after you burn firewood. Even to the extent of the creosote that builds up inside your chimney, or the smoke that actually goes upside your chimney, with proper use. Number one, you would recycle the chimney smoke as fuel, because there's still carbon involved there. And you would also recycle the creosote that was built up inside the chimney. You'd have means by which you could actually change out the pipe real easy, even automatically if you wanted to, if you still wanted to burn firewood. And there's always going to be tons and tons of firewood, because as nature's doing what nature does and trees fall down, you got to have a way to get rid of, you know, the tree limbs that are laying everywhere. Otherwise, you're living in a brush pile. But nonetheless, there's even methods by which to use all that material, everything that nature, you know, is either breaking down or is already broke down, dead or dying or whatever, and all those can be renewable energy sources. And if you're planting trees while you're cutting down trees, it's as simple as that. But, you know, you got people out there protesting with a wooden stick and a paper sign saying, "Save the trees." So, you know, that's why mad science exists, because there's hypocrisies like that. Instead of, getting out there with your wooden stick and your paper sign, you get involved in this situation that we're talking about, and we'll move into the future, and by the time we get there, it will leave a really nice world for our children in the future.
It's a mixed flow reactor that is simulating what we're doing at the Hedley Study site. We have water here, pure water, that is pumped into this reactor here, and then we have pure CO2 that is pumped under pressure and mixes here with the water, and it's being stirred, and then the CO2 charged water flows along this pipe here into the bottom of this column. And this high pressure column simulates what's happening at depth within the rocks. As we go higher and higher up in the column, you know, the concentration gets so high that you reach supersaturation and the minerals, carbon, start to precipitate out, and thereby fixing permanently the carbon dioxide.
9 years after the project first began, things are now on a much larger scale.
This is one of the reinjection wells for the power plant. It's about 30 liters per second flowing through the pipe. No bubbles are visible in the water phase, as you can see in a Coke bottle, for example.
So basically, they're making carbonated water and they're injecting it into the ground. Look, folks, I don't know how many times I gotta say it. 10,000 feet is the highest that you can go without supplemental oxygen. CO2 is nothing more than two oxygen molecules connected to one carbon molecule. Alright? Atom, molecule, whatever, however you want to say it. It doesn't matter. Which makes CO2 heavier than oxygen. CO2 is dangerous because you can suffocate, because it will displace oxygen. It'll push the oxygen that you can breathe away from you while you got this heavier gas in your lung that won't fit in your respiratory system. So that makes it dangerous. Now, carbon monoxide, which is one carbon molecule or atom, which however you want to say it, don't care, it's still heavier than oxygen. And so it does the same thing, but this time around it's small enough where you can get carbon monoxide poisoning in your bloodstream and kill you. So you can suffocate and you'd be poisoned at the same time with carbon monoxide. So, if 10,000 feet is the highest that you can go without supplemental oxygen, how is it that something that is heavier than oxygen magically making it up there to where oxygen can't go? That's the simple of it. But to take that and understand that CO2 falls, that's how plants end up getting it, you know, then that's not even an issue. But they're basically making CO2 water, carbonated water, and pushing it down into the ground. Spending who knows how many thousands, if not millions of dollars to do so. But either way, wasting all that technology on a non-problem, when you could take all those funds and push it in on a real problem and solving the efficiency, so that whenever we do use power, we're not using it in an inefficient manner, then that means we are basically not having to use near the amount of fuel input in order to get the work done that we want to get done, period. But using just the wind and solar alone and the thermal that's already existing, we've already got more power than we could ever use in a trillion lifetimes.
That's because all the CO2 is completely dissolved in the water.
In 2014, only 2 years after injection began, core samples showed that 95% of the re-injected CO2 had been mineralized. This proved that the CarbFix method is much faster than conventional carbon capture and storage, where mineralization will only occur after hundreds or even thousands of years.
We are currently capturing about 10,000 tons of CO2 per year, and this is about 25% of the CO2 emissions from the power plant. We doubled the capacity this year, and we're taking it in stages, and we'll see how far we get in the next years.
I think the future application of this will be in coastal areas where we have abundant water, where we can, you know, have injection wells actually directly drained from land out to the ocean floor.
We've been talking about energy storage. Why do we need to talk about carbon storage as well?
Well, a big part of this picture so far has been around decarbonisation. And we talked about how energy storage can help decarbonise the electricity system. Of course, that's not the only sector or system that needs to decarbonise.
So it's all joined up then?
It's absolutely all joined up. And there'll be a number of sectors that will be quite difficult to decarbonise, like aviation, shipping, maybe heavy transport. And so for these sectors, we may need to think about other solutions.
What are those solutions? Because we've looked at two there. Capturing it through an artificial tree, locking it away permanently in the ground. Is that it? Do we just go, hey, we've sorted the problem, we walk away?
Well, I think that would be not a very sensible thing to do. We've got so much carbon to remove from the atmosphere, a really big challenge for the next 50-100 years or so. And so I don't think we should just be relying on this carbon capture and storage technology to solve that entire puzzle. The technology, whilst there are a lot of exciting developments, is largely unproven at scale. We're not totally sure what the costs are going to be, and we don't know how people are going to respond to this technology. So I think we need to see it as part of the solution rather than an excuse to keep going the way that we have been.
Isn't there a danger that we're going to just demonise carbon?
Well, it's a possibility, and I mean, we shouldn't forget that carbon is all around us. It's in the trees. So when we talk about biomass and biomass energy, which is often regarded as a clean energy source, fundamentally, that's carbon. So I think carbon plays a very natural role in our daily lives and in our energy cycle. And
oh,
so
yeah,
on.
Because we live in a carbon-based world. That's what the deal is. Everything in this world is carbon-based, including you. All right? Look, folks, I've about played enough of all that. But either way, if you're watching in on Twitch, you see this setup that I got. It's basically to push the limits of efficiency. And when it comes down to energy storage, what you're seeing right there is energy storage in its finest, and it's actually going to get better. Because I'm in the process of a project right now where I'm going to build heavy-duty storage banks that are capable of storing a lot of power. And a lot of power. I'm talking about a lot of power. And so with that said, if you paid attention to anything I've been talking about on how this system actually functions, if you're watching in on Twitch, the transformer not getting hot, the bridge rectifier is not getting hot, the loads are not getting hot, and the driving forces are not getting hot, with the exception of the actual AC wall adapter, the 5-volt one that's up at the top. I have to tilt the camera up there so you can see that one. That's a 5-volt USB charger that's running off a power supply that's fluctuating between 113 and 114 volts AC at the moment. And then at the bottom down there, I got a 9-volt AC adapter that is pushing the power forward. Low current, and all its purpose is to raise the doggone voltage up to store pressure in capacitors. And the only losses in the system will be the standard way that we use it, the conventional way, is from that power source, the 5-volt input. The primary on that is getting too much power from the power grid, so it's getting warm. The longer it runs, the warmer it gets. The transformer, the 9-volt transformer, same thing. On the primary side, the power grid's sending too much power to it, so it gets warm. We can solve that problem as well. And once the energy comes into your home, how you distribute it is up to you. You already paid for it at that point in the game. And so if you can turn around and use that energy incredibly efficient to drastically reduce your power needs, what's coming inside that wall outlet right there, one single wall outlet is more than enough power to run your entire house, period. And that might sound crazy to most, because you got, well, you know, you got to add up all these watts and currents and kilowatts and amp hours and all this kind of craziness. No, you just take that power, you do what nature does, and you use it efficiently. You can distribute that power around. You can take and change it from current to voltage, store massive amounts of power all over your entire house, and use it as needed, and basically be able to run your appliances without having to have them under a forced load. Basically, that's a new terminology, forced load. You're forcing too much power through those devices, and you're causing them to get hot. Those devices don't need near the amount of power to run. And if you want to test that theory, get you a Variac and some capacitor banks, and first run the fan directly off of a Variac, and then measure all the temperatures, then connect the capacitor bank after the Variac, before the motor, and then do the same exact test and watch to see the differences in the temperatures of what it's running, because now that's acting as a buffer between that. And even the Variac itself having a buffer between the Variac and the wall outlet is a place for any energy that Variac can't use is being dispersed out. It's basically allowing it to go off into another load. And so if you're drawing some of that current away from the load, then it's not sitting there constantly heating it up and causing it to eventually reach its thermal breakdown and fail. So with that said, folks, I hope you learned something here today. I hope I've been helpful. I got a lot of things in the works, and I hopefully you jump around there on the Shaziz.com, ShazizRadio.com. Well, actually, you can go to Shaziz.com. It has links to everything, including YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and all that kind of stuff. And if you join me over on Twitch, I'm going to be doing a lot of live stream, real-time experiments so that I can show you, and you can ask me questions in the chat room about what I'm doing and all that kind of stuff. If you share these links, it'll help me out. And I want to try to give you, a competitive edge as far as between the people and the doggone corporations and the governments that's keeping you under their thumb. And so you don't have to pay so much on your doggone electric bill, if any at all. Look, they're going to accidentally give the world free energy. I believe they've already done it to this stage. But it's at some point, it's going to be completely and utterly irrefutable. And once you realize about efficiency, efficiency is the key. You make your appliances run really super efficient, then that generator is going to run super efficient. And then when you realize that you can do that with a small amount of voltage, you can do the same amount of work that you was doing with all that current before, and everything seems to last longer, and it works better, it's not getting hot, then you'll understand what it is that I've been saying and why I've been saying it all this time. So with that said, I'm going to end the Twitch live stream. Thanks for everybody in there. Thanks a lot, Steven, and Everybody who comes in and says hi, if you share these links with people, and even the video after this show is actually going to be a video on Twitch that will be up so that you can go back and watch it in case you missed it. Or you can just download the podcast on ShazizRadio.com or Shaziz.net, wherever I store it. But I'll pop in links in there for everybody. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and end the Twitch stream. Peace and love, everybody. I hope you join me on Twitch for live virtual lab kind of deal so I can show you what I'm coming up with and share all the messages with you. So with that said, peace and love, and take care out there on Twitch. All right, so we ended the Twitch live stream. Now it's time to end the mad science over here. Folks, I'm trying to do my part, and hopefully y'all would get interested and want to help out, you know, do your part, that kind of stuff. Just share the link, share the information, and, you know, bring people over here to say hi once in a while. You can always join in on the radio show via Skype or, you know, jump in the chat room, throw in comments. People, don't forget to check out Steven's resource page link. He's done a lot of compiling of all different types of alternative energy. There's a lot of brilliant individuals out there that have a lot of talent. My friend Thomas, I got a link up there for his BorgSteamFactory.com. He's the one that made them cool goggles that I showed you in one of the streams. Go over and say hi to him as well. Add me on Skype, add me on Facebook, Twitter, and all that kind of jazz, and get involved and ask questions and help me spread my videos and information around so that we can
get my creation fly!
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Ah, crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.